Have you ever heard that story that Napoleon used the Egyptian Sphinx for target practice and shot its nose off? Or maybe you've heard that a French astrologer named Nostradamus correctly predicted nearly 500 years of human history. Or maybe someone told you that the legendary blues guitarist Robert Johnson sold his soul to the devil at a crossroads in Mississippi. These stories are what I like to call historical myths, great little tales that may or may not have any basis in historical fact. On Our Fake History, we explore these historical myths and try to determine what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story, it simply must be told. If you dig stories about death-obsessed emperors, lost civilizations, desperate sieges, voodoo black magic, and famous historical figures you thought you knew, then Our Fake History might just be your new favorite podcast. If you dig it, then subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, happy 4th of July. This particular compilation is the great Mike Lynch, who's my co-author on all the books, doing promo for all the past books. And remember, it's coming out July, 19th? That's right. So enjoy that. Go to amcroll.com and hit the banner and pre-order because it just helps. First, there's Geico. Would you love to save some money on your insurance? Of course you would. And who doesn't love a deal when it comes to great rates on insurance for everything? Geico can help. Insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, RV, even your homeowners, condo, or renter's insurance. They are all covered with Geico. Save even more with special discounts when you bundle coverages together. Plus, they have an easy-to-use Geico mobile app and 24/7 roadside assistance, so it's easy to switch to Geico. It's a no-brainer. Switch today and see just how much you could save at geico.com. Go there and get a rate quote or contact a local agent.
Hello and welcome to Corolla Classics for July 4th, 2022. That's right, we're giving Adam and the crew a day off. We'll play some classic clips for you. My name's Chris Loxamana. I'm the executive producer of the Adam Carolla Show. And with me, as always, Corolla archivist, super fan Giovanni.
Hey, everybody. Happy 4th of July. Happy America. I love America.
Happy 4th of July to you too, Gio. Now, we have a special themed episode for today in honor of Adam's upcoming book, Everything Reminds Me of Something, Advice, Answers, But No Apologies. We're gonna revisit clips where Adam has talked about his previous books, which were co-written with Mike Lynch. So we're going to hear a lot from Mike Lynch as well. And we're just going to go through the history of Adam's books coming out. And by the way, Adam's upcoming book is available for pre-order. Go to Amazon or just go to adamcarolla.com. We have the ebook. You can get the regular hardcover book, the audiobook. All comes out July 19th. All right. What do we have for our first clip?
I got my pre-orders in, by the way. Yeah, even superfan Giovanni still pre-orders everything, sometimes twice.
That's amazing. Audiobook, superfan.
Hardcover, and paperback when they release that.
Yes.
First up, we got Adam Carolla Show 435 featuring my American hero, Mike Lynch, much like all these clips coming up. This one's from November of 2010. It's Book Talk with Lynch while they were doing In 50 Years We'll Be Chicks. But again, we're focusing on the new book, and you can pre-order it today. Check it out.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get it on. Mandate, get it on. And thank you all who have purchased this book. Again, we don't have a big platform to launch this baby. And the plan was, I was not a celebrated author. I had no experience writing books. So the plan was they were going to take a chance on me and see if it paid off. And it was you guys who made it pay off, and let me explain why. First off, Mike Lynch is in studio. Mike?
Yeah, I'm getting it on.
Mike is, very instrumental in writing this book. Those of you who know me know that I'd say Squid would have a better chance at writing a book than I would if you just plopped it down on
brings
one of those.
Brings his own ink.
brings its own ink and just slop it down onto that keyboard. The one that picked out the winner of the World Cup would probably have a...
Too soon, Adam.
Oh, you're right. I shouldn't make that joke. Point is this. I could not have written this book without Mike Lynch. Now, initially, Mike Lynch was going to just keep tabs on what was going on, bring me some jokes, keep track of my ideas, and then me and my wife were going to sit around and type that. This is a bad idea. As a matter of fact, you know, if you think about marriage just in general... Well, do the math. People go, oh, no. Don't ever run a business with your wife. You guys will be arguing at it, you know. Don't try to hike the Appalachian Trail with your wife. You know, every once in a while, there's one of those stories where said, me and my wife rode a mountain bike to San Francisco, and we fought the whole way, me. And then at some point, somebody goes, if you just hang out, oh, yeah, you guys in a bachelor apartment, that's not going to last. And then you realize if you just do the wife math, maybe getting married is not a great plan.
Don't run a business with them. Don't ever do any projects with them. But feel free to have kids with them. That'll be easy.
And live together. Well, everyone knows the death knell of every relationship is spending too much time together. So let's just explore that in an even more broader universal pattern here. Maybe getting married.
I think you've just found the flaw in 2,000 years of monogamy. You've finally cracked the code.
Yes, I think the leading cause of divorce is marriage. So, and it'd be hard to argue with that. So Mike came in, my wife and I. Basically, what I would do is I would dictate to Lynette, and then I put the dick in dictate, by the way, because I would say something and then she would say, yeah, I got it. And then she would say it back to me the wrong way. And then I would say it back in a snarky tone. And then she'd say, what's up your ass? And then we'd get in an argument, and then she would write down what I was yelling at her, and confusion set in. So eventually I said, we got to get Mike Lynch in here, and I'm going to pay Mike Lynch, and we're going to do this. Now, the thing that's nice, and the thing that makes me want to thank all of you people for what you've done for me and Mike Lynch, is they did not think that my audience would buy a book. I was not exactly Sarah Silverman or one of these hipster types who somehow the folks over in Manhattan and Tribeca thought we could move books or products. So we got a nice advance, not a huge one, just a nice one. And I broke Mike off a piece, and I gave him $20,000. And I said, hey, buddy, help me with this book. And hopefully there'll be some better days to come. Well, something that is fairly unheard of in the publishing world, we got our next deal and our next advance before this book came out, which was substantially more, still not Sarah Silverman money, but substantially more, and we were able to break Mike off a bigger chunk, and thus Mike is now writing for a living. Am I putting words in your mouth?
No, that's great. Absolutely.
And Mike busted, and it's a very good example of, here's what happened, essentially, and from both sides. Mike essentially, I don't want to say worked for free, but at $20,000, he probably averaged $7 an hour with all the time that he put in on this book. And with the money I made on this book, with the amount that I normally make for what I do, I was way under what I my pay scale. But I realized, all right, you got to put in a little extra time. You're going to have to prove something to somebody, and then you can get a payday down the road. And a lot of that payday does count on how many of you guys tell your friends about it and so on and so forth, or buy it for a Christmas gift for some of your friends. Because let's face it, you guys are doing an awesome job, and that's fine and dandy. But at a certain point, you're going to have to tell a couple of friends to purchase the book. Otherwise, we're just not going to see the kind of numbers that we'd love to see. But the point is I sort of did it, I wouldn't say pro bono, but for me, not a big money maker, and for Mike, not a big money maker. But now, based on the relative success we've had, the next one has come around, and we'll already start working on that.
Let me say this, though. Money always great, but a job where you go up to Vista del Lago, the stately Corolla Manor, and get to eat your food, mm-hmm. and play with your kids, and wrestle with your dog, and... Yeah. Just generally, it was more hanging out than it was the most fun and fulfilling job I've probably had out here.
Yes. Thank you. Well, tell people what the schedule was like.
I'd get up to your house about 9 a.m., make sure I wipe my feet on the way in.
Yes.
Very weird that way. By the way, for a guy who pees in the sink, I require quite a bit from other people. I just don't like when people walk in. I like the there's a fucking mat there. It says welcome. It should say wipe your fucking feet, Dillweed. But it says welcome, now wipe your feet on it. Maybe it saying welcome makes people not want to wipe their feet on it.
I'm already welcome. I don't need to, you know.
But maybe it should be the Iranian flag. You know what I mean?
Right.
Something you'd want to wipe your feet, you know? All right. Yeah. All right.
So picture
you
come of Hitler.
Up, you come up at, I do have one. If you flip it over.
Oh, okay.
It's like those dartboards that have the baseball game on the other side. You never see it.
Yeah, and the mustache is a little brush to, you know, get in between the...
Yeah. So you come up at 9 o'clock, wipe your feet.
Right. Get a cup of coffee going, and we would just start writing. And, you know, at the time this was happening, you were, you know, completely immersed in... you know, the NBC pilot a lot of the time and various other projects. And so there was a lot of, you know, schedule shifting. There were some times where I'd come up at night too, but fairly regularly we would do, it was a 9-to-5 day.
Mm-hmm. Another good example, parable for people, if you will, and something that took me a long time to learn, and I know I preach about this a lot, but it's really like, the notion of writing 300 pages, and when I say 300 pages, I mean more like 400 pages because we edited out about 100 pages and you edit more paragraphs and words out. But to crank out somewhere about 300 pages or maybe 100,000 words for a guy who failed driver's ed because he wouldn't write a 10-page report and a guy who's never strung together more than 3 pages, and I include the cover page and the glossary when I would write a book report, that notion seemed daunting, to say the least. And not only daunting, but overwhelming. But there is something that I have figured out, and it's that corny sort of a journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step. I just knew, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, I would say, then come over for 90 minutes or an hour or 2 hours, and let's just see if we can blast out 30 pages or 15 pages. Or we'd have a thing where we'd be 82 pages in, and I'd say, well, why don't you just stop by in between your gigs or in between my gigs, and let's see if we can get to 100 pages before Friday.
Right.
And it's kind of effective, because what happens is you blink your eyes, and the book's coming out.
Yeah, and we were smart about it too, where we kind of, we didn't go, okay, here's this chapter, we're going to write this chapter, here's this chapter. We skipped around to keep it kind of interesting for both of us, which keeps the creative juices flowing.
Right.
I was looking down while you were speaking, by the way. At one point, this book, I kept kind of statistics as we were going through, 108,801 words.
Yeah.
On our first draft when we sent it in. Now, couple of chapters got cut, and a lot more within the chapters got cut.
But, yeah.
Well over 100,000 words at one point.
So at that point, you send them in, and then it gets edited down. And for some reason, there's always a chick at the other end of the line for me. I always thought it'd be a fat guy named Marty. That's one of the things I address in the book, who basically understands my references or knows what I'm talking about. Suzanne O'Neill over at Crown and Random House, although at some point we had lunch and she said, you don't know the name of my company, do you? And I said, no, but academic. I'm going to write as good a book as I can write. And I can wholeheartedly say and truthfully say that this was the best that I had to offer, and Mike and I scrutinized this book quite a bit, and it was not mailed in, as they say. And it's not because I'm a hardworking guy, it's just because I have an ego. Like, my worst nightmare is having somebody read my book and go, meh, you know, I usually like Corolla, but not his best. Mm-hmm. And if you know me well, and here's what to expect, and Mike, again, stop me at any time and tell me if you think I'm misspeaking or you want to correct me. This book is, if you know me well and you listen to this podcast and you're what you would call a fan, what this book will contain is many of the thoughts you've heard before, but laid down in a concise way. Because when I'm shouting about whatever it is I'm shouting about, whether it be, you know, crappy iced tea or the school system or whatever, maybe The View, whatever topics I might be crowing about at any given time that you've all heard 3,000 times, this is a concise version of it. It is a thought out, put in the right order, laid out just the way I want it, sort of final version of that rant. And then mixed in with some thoughts you probably haven't heard before.
Yeah, I think you're undercrediting how much new stuff is in here. I think that there's I'm going to kiss your ass for a moment. The thing I like about you as a comedian is the thing that I like about bands like the Grateful Dead and Fish in music. It's never the same twice. Like, mm-hmm. even though, yeah, there might be subjects that you've talked about on this podcast, it's different because every time we would sit there and you'd pace around the office and I'd type it. It was new, fresh thoughts on the same topic. It wasn't just complete, you know, oh, we've heard this before.
Right. And then I would yell it out, and then Mike would read it back to me. And that's the only way I can work is to hear it back to me, because I realize that when you read things, your mind is sort of like a computer that has that sort of spell correct in it and mixed in with a little spackle, where you'll sort of connect things, make them right, make them flow, make them fit. I can't tell you how many times I've looked at something, and this is me. Again, I have a fourth grade education, but where I've seen my name spelled C-O-R-O-L-L-A and not noticed it 10 times just because I've made it C-A-R in my head. I've sort of corrected it. You'll sort of correct things. I mean, the language is complicated. Oftentimes, like when you hear you'll hear a comedian speak, you'll hear a senator speak, you'll hear the president speak. And instead of saying, you know, micro, they'll say macro or something, mm-hmm. but you kind of know what they mean.
The context, it makes sense.
Yes. And so in your brain, you'll just sort of flip it and you'll go, all right, I know what they're talking about. And when you read it to yourself, you'll do that.
Even just individual words, you won't notice typos because the brain process is like the word that, it sees the T at the beginning and the T at the end. And if you have the H and the A flipped in the middle, it won't notice it because it looks at it as a whole.
Right. The fact that I wrote cunt instead of that, it's not something I would have caught. But when Mike reads it out loud.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the cunt chapter.
Right. So I would have Mike then read everything aloud to me. And then I would hear it. And then also not only typos and misuse of grammar and spelling and that kind of stuff, but you can really just hear the flow. Like you can really go, no. And especially one of the things you hear is you hear repetition when mm-hmm. somebody reads it out loud. So Mike was kind enough to type out the stuff and then hit save. And I don't know how long it took. I guess people say, how long did it take? I guess I'd say about 6 months to write the book.
I think so, yeah. I mean, you know, in fits and spurts initially, and then once things really got kicked in at the beginning of the year. You know, we started a little bit in December of 2009, and mm-hmm. then in January 10, I quit Wanda Sykes and just started doing this full time with you.
Right. And again, the way we would do it is I would just say, when you have time, Mike, thankfully, is flexible and unemployable. So he would give his thing. And, you know, my whole thing, too, was instead of doing a bunch of marathon 12-hour sessions and burning out, and creatively, I don't think you're any good after 9 hours anyway, we'd do 2 hours here and 4 hours there. And we'd also do a lot of, like, we didn't have any sacred days. Like, I'd say, look, Lynette and the kids are going out to some gymboree on Sunday at noon, not during football season, obviously. Right. And I'd say, what are you doing? And you'd say, well, I'm seeing some patients in the morning. And I'd say, all right, well, come over at noon and we'll just go noon to two on Sunday. And again, we didn't have any days where, oh, no, that's my Sabbath. I don't work on Sunday. And I would rather put in a couple hours on a few odd Sundays than do a bunch of marathon Mondays.
Right.
And again, creatively, there should be something like they have rules for guys who are commercial pilots, where it's like, well, you have to have more than a 12-hour layover to sober up and not be fatigued and blah, blah, blah. I don't think writing a book, I don't see, it's like cramming for a test. Somewhere around your 15th jolt and your 12th handful of no-dos, and you're going on 16 hours of staring at the same chemistry book, I don't feel like you're retaining anything.
In the writing process, for sure, and probably even more so in the editing process, because if you get foggy and you start not caring, you don't notice those small details that make a huge difference, such as, you know, which flipping words to make sure you end the sentence on the right beat.
Also, what happens is you start floating, and it probably happened to me at least 20 times where I said to Mike, did I say that already? Is that another chapter? Chapter. Is that another chapter? Yeah. Go ahead and then we did. I'd tell you to, you'd put in a word check. You said retard 1,350 times.
I did do a retard count at one point, and we were well into the 30s, and I think we got it down to 25.
Like, see, it's the kind of notes you get from your editor. But our editor, who is in New York, and by the way, I have the feeling that the editor's never in the city. If we moved to New York to write a book, our editor would be in Los Angeles or Miami. Somehow they're never. And you get some emails, and you get some suggestions, and then the idea for the title comes up, and it seems easy enough for a guy like myself. But the problem is, I didn't want to pick a theme. And when you're writing a book, they want you to pick a theme. They're like, we need a theme for this book. And my theme was shit that I complain about. And they're like, well, that's not a title for a book. We need something.
Well, you know, we should say the genesis of this book, the beginning of it was Lynette's suggestion of This Year in Rage, the book. Actually, before that, it was going to be The Rich Man, Poor Man, the coffee table book.
That's a moneymaker. Yeah.
And then Lynette said, no, do This Year in Rage. And that was that was where it started. And then we realized by the time it came out, it was going to be Last Year in Rage.
Right.
So,
by the way, she wants a ton of credit for telling me to write a book. like the guy who told somebody, hey, man, you should win World War II. Or I'm going to just tell everyone right now, someone should figure out a way for me to get from L.A. to New York in less than a second. Mm-hmm. And then when that technology comes around, guess who's going to get credit for it? Yeah.
Well, you mentioned titles. I actually have a document here. I think this was still when Lynette was working on it with you, because I don't remember half of these.
Oh, really?
But just a document that says old titles. My Poor Brain. Stream of Consciousness. I Wrote This for You. I Can't Read Either. If you don't have anything nice to say, write a book. My next book will be better. Let me finish my thought. Smarter than your average NASCAR fan, we need to talk.
We need to talk. Sounds like Joy Behar wrote it. I'll take my next one. My next book will be better.
I Hate Your Dad Too. I Hate Your Dad Too is probably what it's. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I do like this, though, by the way. I do remember coming up with this at a certain point, and I'm pitching this for book two right here and now. Daddy's Not Done Talking.
Yeah.
I do like that one.
I like that one, too. And In 50 Years We'll All Be Chicks was not the title of the book, if you recall. It was like the subtitle or the subheading or the subcaption. I don't even know what that's called. What's that called?
I don't know.
That part underneath the name of the movie. It's like the
full title is In 50 Years We'll All Be Chicks and Other Complaints from an Angry Middle-Aged White Guy.
Right. But the In 50 Years We'll All Be Chicks was where and other complaints from a middle-aged angry white guy.
It was flipped.
No, it wasn't flipped. The name of the book, I should have figured this one out. I gave my editor a whole bunch of examples or choices. And the choices were something like, it wasn't flipped. It was sort of like, I don't know, let me put my thoughts in your head or something. And something like the end of Western civilization in 50 years we'll all be chicks. It was like one of these things where it wasn't the main title. It was the little part that the two guys who wrote a book don't know the name of. That's us. Right. And so So she said, I like this is the title of the book. And it's one of these things. It was kind of like crank yankers. Crank yankers used to be called prank puppets, and we just got used to it, mm-hmm. and then we liked it. And then it was kind of like your, it's like your dog's name, which is after a while, it doesn't really matter what it is. It's just that's her. That's mm-hmm. who it is. That's if your dog's Frankie, that's Frankie. It's just mm-hmm. and it bothers you if somebody says, no, we're going to change the name. And I never really was wild about in 50 Years We'll All Be Chicks. You know, I give it a 6.5 or 7. And I thought, And then it started it. And then you start, it becomes the working. You start using it when you're talking about the book and stuff. And then at a certain point, it kind of grows on you a little bit and you start to like it. Now, do you remember the original cover concept?
Are you talking about the bumper sticker one? Or because that was a concept that we had at a certain point, too.
Right. All the lame bumper stickers, all the coexist and my kids, Ace doing it, Louis Pasteur middle school and all that shit.
Yeah. And we were going to, you know, do something. Don't blame me. I voted for Corolla or, you know.
Yeah. Nobody could come up with anything good. Here's the thing that's weird about folks that work with books and work in this industry. I'm also eventually going to write a book about my experience working with Hollywood executives called Not This Idea, But Something Funny, which is, hey, super educated Harvard grad folks that have been working in the television industry for 31 years. How about you spit out something fucking funny? How about instead of not this, how about this? How about something funny? So when you work in
the good version of this.
Yes, that's what you hear. Mike, you've sat in the room with a million of those pitches, right? But here's the whole thing. Hey, you know, when they do the thing where they go, you know, my editor goes, well, when we talk to our PR department or we talk to our creative department or something, they had some, well, not this, but they had. And I just sort of sit around and go, hey, how about you guys come up with something? Like, how about I turn on my computer, check my email and see a really fucking hysterical idea that came from your side of the net.
Yeah.
Just once. Just one time. And by the way, you guys aren't roofers. You're not drywallers. You work in this industry. And I know my editors, smart lady, mm-hmm. she edits for a living, but they have a creative department over there that comes up with the covers and the concepts and all. Come on, baby. How about just once? Just one. Just one?
You're the person judging what's funny. How about proving that you have some taste?
One time, the golf coach who's been telling you what's wrong with your swing for the last 5 years, how about just one time you pick up the Big Bertha and just fucking drive one 280 yards right down the fucking fairway? How about just once?
They don't get past the ladies' tees.
How about just once you don't fucking shank one off a tree behind you? How about just once? How about once, whether it's television, books, or whatever, all they do is tell you what's wrong with your swing and why it's not working. Just one time. Here's the driver, champ. Go ahead and have a hack at it. Never going to happen. But the thing that's weird is, and I know I sound like the biggest dick in the world, but this is your fucking business. Come on, come up with something. So they couldn't come up with the title. And then eventually I came up with one, but to my editor's credit, she came up with the part where she took the secondary part and put it at the front. And then it came up to the cover art and we couldn't come up with anything good. And then at a certain point I had this concept, and again I had this concept that I liked and the editor liked and Mike liked, but James Baby Doll Dixon did not like, which was and there's a funny story involving thanking him that we have to mention as well. I said, how about a picture of me, you know, circa 1950s, think Marlon Brando and the Wild Ones or Wild Bunch or whatever that biker movie was, you know, the hat and the leather jacket and the whole nine yards. How about a picture of me sort of cigarette hanging out of my mouth, wearing the boots, leaning up against a brick wall with a bunch of graffiti and everything on it, looking real tough, like in an alley. But just on the right side and the left side of that picture, just as you could see the book cover sort of turning the corner and going around the inside or going around the back side of the book, you could see just out of just just right by the edge of the page, you could see that that was nothing but a flat with fake brick on it. And we're inside a sound studio, and we had the gay publicist and my assistant holding the latte and somebody holding a cell phone and that whole thing just sort of as the reveal. And everyone dug it. And then my agent, James Baby Doll Dixon, said, yeah, but baby, when you're at an airport and people are walking past it, you really think they're going to take time to open it and flip it open or look around the back? You know, are they going to get the joke, in other words, or is it just going to look like it has a weird distracting border on it? And it was, I like the subtle stuff where you have to sort of discover it, but I did concede and understand that in terms of just moving product, that making people burn calories at the airport was probably not the way to go. So I said, no problemo. The other thing that involves James Baby Doll Dixon is he was not thanked in the book at the end. Initially, I did this thing where the thanking people's a slippery slope. And first off, I wanted to thank you, Mike Lynch, for doing, here's my whole thing. You turn on these TV shows and they have 30 executive producers and three of them do work and 27 do nothing. And when I say nothing, I mean, I should correct that. They hammer checks. They fucking sit on their fat asses and hammer checks. And
there's important drapery decisions, Adam.
Yeah, they do come in and complain about what color the drapes above the kitchen sink and the fake kitchen should be and complain about the color of the outside of the apartment and throw fits over fucking nothing. But essentially, they do nothing. They do nothing. They sit on their fat asses and do nothing. And then they want to be thanked. And not only do they want to be thanked, they want to be recognized. And my whole thing is, when you start thanking everyone, you're thanking no one. And everyone goes, oh, just put another name on there. Well, each name that goes on to this book in terms of me thanking you takes a little bit away from Mike Lynch, who did all the fucking work. I mean, seriously, I don't want to sound like a dick, but if it's Mike Lynch's name and my wife's name and my editor's name, then they can whack it up 33%. And then if you add another name, now it's down to 25%. And a fifth name, now it's 20%. Eventually, when I'm done thanking everyone I played Pop Warner football with at East Valley Trojans, you'll be down into the single digits, Mike.
Currency gets devalued.
Abso-fucking-lutely, if you just keep printing it. So my thing was like, and also, I don't know why, but I'm a dick this way. I'm like, look, Mike Lynch did all the fucking work in this book. My agent put together the deal. He got 10% of that. That's his job. He gets 10% of everything. That's his job. And he did a good job, but he didn't write the book. And I didn't even thank my editor. And I didn't even thank Crown or Random House or anybody. I was just going to thank Mike Lynch because he did all the work and thank my wife because she said, hey, you should write a book other than this coffee table book about the same name game or whatever the fuck.
We're still doing that, Ace.
We're still doing it anyway. So I said, listen, I'm going to thank Mike Lynch and thank my wife so I don't get divorced. And that was it. And then at a certain point, I got to talking to. Listen, you got to thank your editor. And I thought, all right, you're right. She burned some calories. But again, like getting back to my roofer reference, you know, when a guy puts a roof on your house, you pay him, right? And you make him, he makes money. You have a deal. He puts a roof on your house, you give him 30 grand. And, but you don't have to thank him and you don't have to send him over a card that says thank you for you. He gets the 30 grand, you get the roof. And then by the way, when you sell the house, you don't go take a few dollars and give it over to him along with a bottle of champagne. It's just, he comes in, does the roof, gets in his truck, splits and goes and hammers your $30,000 check. That's the deal you guys have made. I don't know why. And I know I'm a dick this way, but that's the way I approach this business. You know, Random House, you wanted to make a deal with me. I'm hopefully going to make you some money. I'll get you your advance back and then some. James Baby Doll Dixon, you put together the deal. You take 10%. That's your job. You guys are doing your job. The thank part, again, I know it's part. I know it's how the business works. For me, it's a part of the business that sort of bothers me. But these people, and I should say that Suzanne O'Neill over there at Random House or Crown, wherever she is, or both.
Crown is underneath Random House.
Yeah. Did do a good job and had a very good relationship and barely any arguments. And Baby Doll did
mostly
a good
political job.
Mostly political. Did a good job. Well, obviously, I get the young chick that doesn't get any of my references and leans very hard toward the left, of course, when I'm going off on my sexist, racist rants, of course. So, of course, that was meant to be. But anyway, so I was told at a certain point, hey, actually, I was told by my agent, you need to thank me. He just came out and said it. He just said, look, that's how it works. I get thanked.
Baby.
And I realized, you know what? That's right. You should be thanked. And Suzanne O'Neill should be thanked. And the agent who put together the deal, although I don't know why there's another agent, but there's another agent. There's a literary agent. Right. He needs to be thanked as well. So I said, you know what? All right. We'll just do it the way they do it. Let's just thank everybody and make everyone happy. And we'll leave it at this because then it's going to keep going. Eventually, Molly's going to need to be thanked. So I said, fine. We'll thank. So I said, we had Mike Lynch and then we had Lynette and then the editors and the agents and everything. So I said, you know, all right. I called my agent or I called Mike and I said, tack these people on. And by the way, this isn't a joke. It's not I don't need people to laugh here. It's not a chapter. We're done with the fucking book. By the time they get to this point, they've already bought it and read it. Who gives a fuck? Moving on. So just tack their names onto the end of the thing. And tack on they did, except for it didn't get tacked on. It got tacked in. And then at a certain point, when the book showed up at my house a week ago, my wife was looking at the acknowledgments at the end and pissed off. Now she's pissed. I said, well, what are you pissed about? You got thanked. And she said, have you read them? And I said, I don't need to read them. I thanked Mike. I thanked you. And then I thanked Dixon and Suzanne O'Neill and so forth. And she said, yeah, why don't you read this? And Mike, why don't you read it to see all how right. it came together?
The uncomfortable part where I read about myself. This book would not be possible without the dedication, wit, and nimble fingers of Mike Lynch. This project would never have become a reality without his involvement. As a matter of fact, he's typing this right now. And also my agent, James Baby Doll Dixon, and my wife, Lynette, who encouraged me to write this book when I was hell-bent on a coffee table book entitled Dade County Black Prom, 1977 to 1985. I should also thank my literary agent, Dan Strone, my editor, Suzanne O'Neill, and the whole team from Crown for letting a guy who's never read a book write one.
Right. Now, my wife was like, well, how did Baby Doll Dixon's name get in front of my name? And I was like, I don't know. I just told him to put Dixon's name on to the thanks thing. I didn't say to wedge it in front of yours, but evidently something did happen.
Well, that was that was me, for the record. That was me, but I will send her.
It doesn't, you know why, you know what I get? Here's what I get. And you guys all, anyone's in a relationship knows that women have the initial blame and then the default setting blame as well. There's the, you know, you should have done something. And then, you know, there's the you should have done something. And then you go, I wasn't even there. And they go, why weren't you there? You know, you don't even care enough to be there. So they believe me, they have a slightly lesser sort of default blame mode. So I got the what the hell's Dixon's name in front of my name for? It sounds like it was Dixon's idea and my idea to write this book. It was my idea. It wasn't Dixon's idea to write this book. How the hell did he get in front of me? And I said, hey, I don't know who you're yelling at. I didn't say to do it that way. I said tack the name on. I didn't say in front of you. I thought they'd tack it on after you. And she went, you didn't even take the time to check, did you? So that's the default blame. That's the default.
Well, Lynette, I'll apologize right now on the air. I put Dixon in front of that, just threw it in there because I thought it would step on the Dade County Black Prom joke to end with, oh, and also Dixon. After that, you end with your joke.
Yeah.
So
that clip from 2010, where Adam was talking about his first book in 50 years, We'll All Be Chicks. And with a assist from Mike Lynch. Look, I'll tell you, Gio, I was really worried when I went on my honeymoon because of what happened to Mike Lynch.
It is a legend.
Yeah.
He was originally the sound effects guy on the radio show. Went on his honeymoon, Bald Brian filled in and completely crushed it. It was a series of events. I don't think, maybe Brian was calculating it, but it seems unlikely he could pull off so many things. And like, I don't know, if Lynch was there, he probably would have caught a lot of that magic in the bottle as well, but he wasn't. And Brawl Brian is now the sound effects guy.
It all worked out.
It did.
All right.
Technically, he may have saved Brian's life.
Look at that. See, Lynch? Good job, buddy. Or I guess I just thank his wife, too, Claire. All right. Mm-hmm. Let's get going with our second clip of the day. Now, this is, we're going to jump ahead about a year, two years, and we're going to hear from Lynch as they talk about not Taco Bell material and them coming up with that book.
Yeah, this is Adam Carolla Show, episode 845. This is a weird one. Mike Lynch kind of took over the hosting duties to play clips from that book, the audiobook, to kind of give an idea of what it's about. But also he filled in on the process. So here's a little chunk of Mike Lynch technically hosting this weird episode of the show. Check it out.
Mike Lynch is with me in studio because we wrote the book together and thought, well, this would be apt and make sense. And let's face it, if we could get the fuck is that? If we could get Alec Baldwin in here, we would, but we can't. So we got to fucking Mike Lynch.
I can talk really gravelly.
Go ahead.
Talk like this.
Yeah, but you got to be talented.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can be Billy Baldwin.
Oh, well, that's easy.
Yeah.
Hell, you beat him when you were in high school. We have decided that a fun show to do today to sort of commemorate the kickoff of the book would just to literally play the first two audio chapters. I don't know how many chapters the book has.
18?
16. And I tweeted someone it was 330 pages the other day, but I don't know how long it is.
It's something like 323 or something like that. I can't say for sure off the top of my head.
But it's thick. It's like a real book and everything.
Yeah.
And for guys that are intellectual lightweights, and you know who you are, it's got plenty of pictures, good old pictures, and a lot of pictures I haven't seen myself. There weren't like stuff I had. There were stuff I had to go get from other people and friends of friends and that
kind of
stuff.
There's a lot of digging to get those pictures.
Yeah, so I think you guys will enjoy the book, and the audiobook, as per usual, is vastly different than the book itself because it's 330 pages. Look at that. Because I went off and I got distracted and I went off on tangents on just about everything. The first two chapters you're going to hear are which two chapters?
It's the very first chapter, including the introduction, your mom's house.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second chapter is your dad's A-frame.
Okay, so that will be today's show, and it'll be about an hour and change, depending on how long we talk. And I believe the audiobook is over 8 hours.
Yeah.
So if you like what you hear, well, go ahead and grab that. All right, so without any further ado, let's listen to chapter one of the audio version of Not Taco Bell Material. Hey, everybody, it's Adam Carolla, and thank you for purchasing the audiobook, Not Taco Bell Material. This will be narrated by moi. That's Mexican for me. So sit back, buckle up, and enjoy. You know what? Forget the seatbelt. Let's throw caution to the wind. As a matter of fact, why don't you shotgun a beer and deactivate the airbag? Let's live dangerously. You ready to get started? Let's do it. First, this book is dedicated to my son, Sonny, and my daughter, Natalia. And Sonny and Natalia, if you're listening to Daddy's voice right now, turn off your iPod. This is as much as you get to hear, because this book is filthy, and you'd never look at me the same, nor would you ever listen to a word I ever said again. Introduction. This is a book of stories, my stories. They range from the pathetic to the maddening to the disgusting to the absurd, but there's something I want to make clear right from the top. All the stories are true. There's not an ounce of exaggeration or fabrication of any of the details. In fact, it's probably worse than I even remember, but my psyche has dimmed it down for my own protection. Let's start off by talking about houses. As a kid, the places I called home were cracked stucco, dirt lawns, and furniture raccoons wouldn't fuck on. But there's another way of looking at homes. They're where you create memories with your family, good and bad, and the pad you launch from when you start your own life. If you want to know where someone is at physically, mentally, financially, spiritually, whatever, look at where they're living. So, I decided to start each chapter by telling you a little bit about the different abodes I've called home. This book will be a journey from the plethora of dumps I was raised in, through the shithole apartments I rented in my 20s, to the homes I purchased and personally renovated when I found some success. Chapter 1, A Cracked Foundation, Mom's House. North Hollywood, California. Year bought, 1951. Purchase price, $10,000. I have a blender that costs that much now. 875 square feet, two bedrooms, one bath, zero hope. This is the first house I grew up in. Technically, there were a couple of stops in Philly and New Jersey before this, but I was a baby and a couple of months in a rental house in Chatsworth as a toddler doesn't really count. This is the house I consider to be my childhood home. The roof was falling off, the porch was falling apart, and at some point, my grandfather decided to rebuild the porch. But in the penny-wise, pound-foolish Corolla tradition, he bought used lumber that had been salvaged from a pier fire. I know, you can't make this shit up, folks. The boards were warped and charred and filled with barnacles and termites. And that porch lived in front of that house for almost 15 years. It was humiliating living in this place. It was called the barn by my neighborhood friends. Actually, mostly Ray. We'll get into him later. Oh, boy, will we. I don't know if we're going to be friends after this. He told me a few months ago he wanted to talk to me about the chapter that was dedicated to him. And I said, yeah, buddy, call me over the weekend. And then, because he's Ray, he didn't write it down and he forgot. Anyway, let's just put it this way. His political career will be over at the end of this book. Done. Now, where was I? That, by the way, was a digression, and there's going to be a lot of those, especially if you heard the first audiobook. But let me get back to the house. It had one bathroom, no dishwasher, no air conditioning, one washing machine, but no dryer, yet it had two front doors. Two front doors, right next to each other at 90 degrees. I never thought it was strange until I dug up some old pictures years later. There's symbolism in it. It made no sense, it didn't conform to any standards, yet it was accepted as if it was completely normal and did not need to be fixed. Just like my family.
Jordan Harbinger, the Jordan Harbinger Show. It's a different kind of sponsor for this episode, the Jordan Harbinger Show. Well, if you're a fan of good podcasts and interesting people, then you're definitely going to want to check out Jordan Harbinger. There's an episode for everyone, no matter what you're into. Jordan talks to Scott Adams about persuasion in a world where facts don't matter. You can go inside the dark world of wildlife trafficking as well. You're always going to find something useful to apply to your life. Routine changes to boost productivity. Slight mindset tweaks to change how you see the world. And, well, I enjoy it. We enjoy Jordan, and I think you're going to too. So you can just search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That is H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, and you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find finer podcasts.
And that was Mike Lynch talking about the writing process of Not Taco Bell Material. I would say the autobiography of Adam. He really gets deep into his childhood and growing up, and each chapter was based off of a place he lived.
It's a brilliant framing device. It's a beautiful book. It's hilarious. In 50 Years, We'll All Be Chicks, comedy book, prophetic and weirdly prescient, more than I think anybody could have imagined. Almost in the vein of like George Carlin's old books. Not Taco Bell Material, just as funny, but just like Chris said, it's got an autobiographical quality to it, but in a non-douchey way. It's a beautiful piece of work.
Totally agree. All right, let's now jump forward three more years to, I would say, Adam's parenting book, Daddy Stop Talking.
It's Adam Carolla Show, episode 1555, featuring Mike Lynch, April of 2015. And we better hope it's a parenting book, otherwise Adam might be into some weird 8mm stuff.
Fun doing the photo shoot for the cover, my wife and my kids, and I know it sounds sort of schmaltzy, but it's fun. My daughter's so pumped for that stuff. She's back there. They got a makeup lady, you know, it's like a makeup lady. I mean, for Yeah, they're eight. Just fun. My son doesn't not moving his needle. Maybe he doesn't have one. Maybe he's a true Corolla, but does not get the allure of being on the cover of a book. So there's that. But I love the permanent part of it. I realize that doing a podcast or a radio show, even a TV show, to an extent, everything just sort of goes up into the ether. You know, I did, I don't know what I did, 350 episodes of Loveline on MTV. I've never even seen one. I don't even know where they are.
Well, they're all at your dad's house.
Well, they're in the box set. Yes. Yeah, they're above the shrine. No, I don't know where they are. I've never seen one. Like they're gone, you know. But a book, I started focusing a little more on books and movies and things like that because I realized that's something you can kind of put on a shelf and leave behind.
Can I tell a quick funny story? So the second book that we did, Non-Talk About Material, had my name on the cover, and thank you again for that. So that one did end up kind of enshrined at my parents' house. But I came home one summer, whatever it was, visiting, there was a copy of Not Taco Bell Material, a statue of some saint. I don't know why, just on the shelf, on the mantle there. Not Taco Bell Material, a saint, and a copy of 50 Shades of Grey. And it was...
Wow.
Yeah, it was emotional whiplash to think that Mom had Not Taco Bell Material, Saint Jude, and 50 Shades of Grey on the same shelf.
I think my mom... It was a long time coming, but I think she may have gotten around to Not Taco Bell Material. She didn't get it from me. I'm pretty sure that was the book I didn't want her to read.
Yeah.
And for well over a year, every other time I saw her, she would say, "Do you have a copy of that book so I could take a look at it?" First off, my family's insane. Because they think the only way that they can, the only way they can get their hands on something is if it's given to them. Like the notion of purchasing something is not, it's not really it's not a thought. It's not even an option, which is a weird thing because you do realize if you put $13 down on that book, I might see $1.25 of it, but. I don't know in this day and age if there's anything more accessible than a book.
Right.
Nothing's easier to ship. Nothing's easier to buy online. There's no confusion. It's not. Right. It's not like you go to Amazon and you type my name in and a question mark comes up and then you have to sift through a bunch of, you jump through a bunch of hoops to get to it. I mean, it's a book. So she would always say, could I get a copy of that book? And I didn't want her to read it, of course. So I was like, well, I don't have one. And she would always, she'd never say, it's your book. Why don't you have a copy? Like
accepted it.
I don't have one. Well, she's indoctrinated me into this. Like, why would you have your own book? Like, you know, and she would never go like, well, first off, wouldn't you have one just up on the shelf just to kind of look at it? Or what if you wanted to reference something or someone came by and you wanted to show off a little or something? But I'd go, yeah, I don't have the book. And then I'd always say to her, I think I got to – because, you know, when you're bullshitting, it's important to get it's important to talk it into the ground and to put a lot of detail into it. I'd say – and I didn't want her – I don't know why, but I'd always go, I think they may have given me a case or something maybe back at the shop. I think there could be a few back in the shop. And now all of a sudden it didn't seem so insane that I could not get my hands on
a copy
of my book.
But still way out of reach that she would ever show up here.
She's never been here. No. I don't know. Gary, has my mother ever been to this either shop?
Who?
Okay. To be fair, I think we did her house once from here to there.
8 minutes. Or maybe it was 11 minutes and 8.1 miles or something, but it was somewhere like that.
You would toy with the notion of not getting on the freeway if you were driving from her house to here. But anyway.
That's about 2,992 miles versus what I took to get here today.
I live in her neighborhood, so I can tell you, even with the worst traffic taking side streets, it's 12 and a half minutes.
She's never set foot in here, much less the other place with all the Newman cars and everything. But she wanted a copy, and I never... She asked me 18 times. By the way, the other thing that's funny about her and me is I'm one of these guys that sort of prides myself. I wish others would do this. I don't like being asked or told things twice. I try to ask that of others, and I really try to pride myself on not having somebody go, "We discussed this before, but let's discuss it again. Right. We need you to do this." You know, it's like when I'm doing a TV show and there's three cameras and it's a little bit chaotic, and the director will say, "Look, you know, make sure you're not blocking the camera. You know, it's a situation. We're coming out from the garage. We're diving into the kitchen. The cameramen are running in there, but sort of feel your camera, find your camera, and don't block it with your back, you know." Mm-hmm. If he has to come tell me again, it bums me out, because I just feel like in life, whether it's rinse your coffee mug or, you know, lock the deadbolt after you open the French doors, or, you know, don't leave your purse on the passenger seat in the parking lot of the Costco, you're going to get your window broken. Like, I feel like I go through my whole life just sort of telling people that stuff. Mm-hmm. They never listen, or... It's. I mean, I go into, you know, with my wife, I sometimes get into the mid three-digit number, like a mid three-digit number with discussions of same right. topic, and it drives me nuts, because it's like, why are we wasting our precious time revisiting this? And so I'm that way. I'm very much that way. And if somebody says, you know, if it kills me that if Mike said, "Hey, I'm coming out on Thursday, I left a blah, blah, blah over with you, or I want to show you something, or I want to show my friend something, could you bring it with you at the shop and show him on when I come out," I'd go put the shit in front of the door or in my car that day, right. Because I'd hate the feeling of walking through the thing and then Mike going, "Hey, did you bring the thing from the house? I thought I'd show my friend," and I go, right. "Oh, fuck. I hate right. that feeling."
Well, because coming from such a family of disappointers, you never want to disappoint.
I maybe that's it. I don't know. Mike knows a lot about psychology. I don't know if that's something you read in me or not. But I just don't like the feeling that somebody told me something and I dropped the ball. Mm-hmm. And my mom, somewhere around the 41st time, she said to me, you know, she's coming over to my house. I know she's coming over to my house, you know, on Sunday. I know a week in advance. When she says, "Do you have a copy of the book?" And I go, "Ooh, man. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at the shop. Damn, I was at the shop Friday. I should have brought a copy back for you." Like, she should have known that's not me.
She should have. But that would require her knowing you.
I would. So I told her literally 41 times, "Oh, man, it's at the shop." And by the way, the shop is, you know, here's something fun, Gary. Let's have some fun with this. The shop is closer to her house than where I currently live, or it's less than halfway, I think, between my home address and this one. And I would include my old address as well. At least it's as close as my old address and halfway to my new address. So the mythical shop should have been stopped by at some point, but it just cannot. I do think she may have gotten hold of it at some point. She didn't get it from me. but I think like maybe a cruel listener sent it to her.
It's a Kimmel joke right there.
There's a Kimmel joke right there. And I just have the feeling she read it. I can't verify it. But you guys are going to have to purchase an extra, well, let me see, mom, stepdad, sister, dad. Step family will be fine. But you guys, there's going to be about four or five books that you guys are going to have to pick up the slack with.
Right.
And just go out and, you know, when you buy one, just buy one for Elijah. I don't know what to tell you, but that'll be, you buy that extra book or download that extra audio book, and that'll be for my mom.
Right.
And for my dad and for my sister and my grandmother who's passed. I don't want to get emotional here, but I'd like to think she wouldn't have bought the book either.
Yeah.
I'd like think
that's how she'd want it.
That's how she'd want it. She'd want to not have to. That's how she'd want it.
It's all actually right. In her will. No matter what.
Will. They didn't have any form of will in my house. What will? It's so funny. Like, what shall we be leaving?
They didn't have will to live.
That's right. No will.
Would you love to save some money on your insurance? Of course you would. And who doesn't love a deal? When it comes to great rates on insurance for everything, GEICO can help. Insurance for your car, truck, motorcycle, boat, RV, even your homeowners, condo, or renter's insurance. They are all covered with GEICO. Save even more with special discounts when you bundle coverages together. Plus, they have an easy-to-use GEICO mobile app and 24/7 roadside assistance, so it's easy to switch to GEICO. It's a no-brainer. Switch today and see just how much you could save at geico.com. Go there and get a rate quote or contact a local agent.
All this month, stream the funniest films for free on Pluto TV. Watch comedy classics like Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy, and Mean Girls. Or drop in for a Tyler Perry marathon with a Madea family funeral and Madea's witness protection. Pluto TV also has hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and TV shows like Get Shorty, Be Cool, Key and Peele, Comedy in Color, and more. And no contracts, no subscriptions, no fees, no joke. So download the Pluto TV app on your favorite streaming device and start laughing today. Pluto TV, drop in, watch free.
And that was Adam talking about Daddy Stop Talking back in 2015 with Mike Lynch. All right. Let's get going with our next clip, and we're going to jump now to 2019 when we had Mike Lynch on.
This is Adam Carolla Show, episode 2708. Mr. Skin, Mike Lynch, Gina Grab, Brian Bishop. This is the portion with Mike Lynch. It's December of 2019. We get even more insight into just how Adam and Lynch pull this kind of stuff off. And it's always great to hear from him now that he's remote. Whenever he appears on the show, it's like, oh yeah, this guy works here too.
So Mike is out here. We're working on a book together, working on the stand-up together. He's sleeping in the theater down there. Comfortable, yeah. Mike? Everything good?
Great. They're rarely heard from Mike Lynch. I feel like you're a mystery character.
You are.
Yes. To a lot
you're
of the
man
audience.
Behind the curtain.
What would you like the audience to know about you? Maybe something that is assumed or gets discussed once in a while or whatever. Is there something you have to clear up or say? Oh.
I think the thing I want to clear up the most is that I'm not Mike August or Mike Dawson, because that's typically what I get at whenever I go to these live events and shows.
Hey, Mike, he's talking about you, you fuck ass.
He's coming on Take a Knee this week. Mike is. He's going to stick around and do that.
Yeah, I'm nervous, actually. I got to admit, because it's the first time I'm a guest as opposed to just a dude that's part of the show. Mm-hmm. I have something to plug. It's bizarre to me.
Well, let's talk about your journey a little bit. You moved back home, basically, to Lowell, Massachusetts. Right. You started working on your practice and getting your clinical hours and certifications and everything, and now finally ready to strike out on your own?
A two-year process. It should have been a two-year process per the regulations. Turned out to be about six.
Didn't you get kind of screwed by the board?
I got very screwed by the board, yes. Yes.
What happened? Didn't mean to downgrade it.
Are you sitting? Okay. You have to do 2 years full-time experience. I was in the process of doing that. Then I applied for the license. And they said, well, your graduate work from California, this doesn't count, that doesn't count. Long story, very short, was semesters versus quarters.
Oy,
turned into – essentially it came down to one credit. I ended up suing the board and losing, so another couple grand on top of that. Then going back to school, another $6,000 on top of that to do a bunch more credits. And then once I get through with that, they say, okay, good. Now you can start getting those hours. So basically everything I had been doing the entire time I thought was counting did not count. So I have now done more face-to-face therapy than a pilot needs to do in the cockpit to get a commercial aircraft
license. If you're in the Lowell area, and you don't even need therapy.
Just come in, drop a couple of bucks.
Were they alleging that people in California are a different kind of crazy than people back east? Because they're not.
It's the worst kind of bureaucracy. It's different. Every state is completely different. They don't communicate with each other. They don't decide, there's reciprocity. It doesn't count. It was essentially
I'm dealing with permits and the city of Glendale, and the plans have to be submitted to the fire department. The first thing is nobody gives a fuck whether you ever get your license or ever make your structure. Nobody cares. That's like number one, nobody really gives a shit. Number two, there is no timeline. For you, there's a timeline.
Yeah.
You have a family, you have a career, you have a building, like you have a definite timeline.
Right.
Yours is a kind of a snare drum and theirs is a slow drip on a faucet. And they're like, come back Friday and see if somebody's here. It's like, nobody's there. Okay. Well, then call on Monday and we won't call you back, but
start
then try again on Tuesday.
Like, yep.
They don't give a fuck they don't care.
I wanted just the wall certificate, just the thing that says my license number 1768. You know, I wanted that wall certificate. You have to, $30 or whatever. Please wait up to 3 months.
3 months?
Literally, it says it in the, it will take up to 3 months for us to print this thing for you.
Right. So
and so for, all the kindness that's in their hearts, the Medicare for All idea, fuck that. Because if this is the system
now,
that I was fighting through, like,
you'd only
people
imagine.
Will be dying.
Yeah. Well, it's this weird helpless feeling because the government has dominion over you and they get to just say stuff, like we need a handicap ramp to the whatever. It's like nobody's going up there. It's for storage. Well, do the ramp. They just do whatever. They can fucking say whatever they want. It's all super expensive. It's all super lengthy. You got to pull another permit, everything else. And they don't care. And my thing is, and they get a little drunk with power. Like, they know it's 6 weeks. And you go, can we expedite that? And they go, no. And keep talking. It'll be 8 weeks. Like, that's just the way it goes. It doesn't bring out the best in everyone to have absolute power and absolute. There's no competition. I have absolute power over you, and I'm on zero timeline, and I get paid the same whether you ever get your permit to hang on the wall or you ever get your building permit. It doesn't matter to me. I got 2 weeks off on Christmas. It never takes a turn for the happy. Like, it never.
There is no God.
I am God. There's never a fucking conversation where they're like, hey, folks, we could do our job a little bit better. Like, I had conversations with people behind the counter building a safety. I went, do your job better. Be better at your job. Would you please? But it doesn't, because it's a system that just breeds lethargy. It's a fucking housing project. It's like, why isn't everyone to work? It's like, because we get a free fucking apartment. It's a shitbox.
And in this particular scenario, there is no incentive because the board, the board of behavioral whatever, is a volunteer position. They meet once a month voluntarily. Mm-hmm. So actually, this process, in addition to everything else, took an extra month because the two people who represent my type of license on the board, they just didn't feel like showing up in July.
Oh my God.
Okay, yeah. Now listen.
So it waited till August.
I don't blame the super slow, lethargic, bloated fucking bureaucracy people, because that's what they do. And that's what I do too. If you shoved me into that environment, I'd be apathetic. I'd be a little angry. When people come in, it's like, I got to get up and do work now. Like, you're angry at the people. It's like the fucking security at LAX. Like, oh boy, now I have to do my job because this person's going to Phoenix. I don't blame them, because that's what it creates and that's who it attracts.
Right.
Who are all the fucking people voting for more of this? I need more. Who are you, young 19-year-old? You're creating a fucking hellhole for yourself. It's going to be a bureaucratic hellhole. Like, hey, we're going to have free education, free college tuition, and free reparations, and free housing, and free kickbacks, and free transportation, and free. You are going to fucking destroy this entire country if that's what you're looking for. Because while it sounds awesome, free this, free that, bigger this, more bureaucracy, more oversight, more of that, you will be fucking run over by it. It will destroy this country. I don't know who's attracted you. And hey, cowards who want everything for free, fuck off.
Well, and
and it's killing you. Sorry.
Oversight by people who don't do the jobs that they're overseeing. Oversight by people who don't know how to make it better, smoother, more efficient.
Dr. Drew could fill up the Grand Canyon with all the fucking pencil-pushing lawyers and bureaucrats who are telling him how to do his job and what he can't do and what he can do. I'm just saying, people, I don't know why you want to vote in more of this. You want more promises that never works. You want more. Mm. You want more of this. I can get you free. I can do that. We need more. You need a bigger government to give out all this stuff and to maintain all this stuff. Ugh. It's so fucking sad, all this soft, entitled, sexist shit that's fucking ruining everything.
Someone should write a book about that.
Yes. If thank only. God. We just did the cover shoot, by the way. Phil's bouncing around here in his...
In costume?
Yes. Phil's in his service. Did you take any pictures of Phil?
Yeah.
Yeah, we got a few. We can give them to Maxipata. All right. Good. Be careful what you ask for. It never fucking works out.
You know what's ironic about everything you just said when you said, who wants this? My first thought was, after you said that, anyone who's not using those services is voting for it.
Right.
You'd think it's the other way around, but it's not.
Right. Yes. I fucking agree. And this whole sort of like vote for a vote, it drives me nuts. Like, my mom's vote's going to cancel my vote out. She doesn't fucking leave the house. She never owned a business. She doesn't pay taxes. Why should we have the same fucking vote? Like, of course. And of course, she wants the fucking Meals on Wheels to swing by her pad and drop off some government cheese. Of course, that's what she wants. She wants more of it. It hobbles people. It destroys their life. It's the worst ever. All right. Mike, any other thoughts, observations?
Uplifting thoughts?
Uplifting thoughts.
Yeah, I really turned this, didn't I? Well, clarifying, Brian, not in Lowell, Massachusetts, Burlington, Massachusetts. I'm giving a plug.
Moving on up.
MC-NE.com, menscenternewengland.com. That is my practice.
And Mike is overqualified for your problems.
10,000 hours of schooling.
It says it on his card. Your problems ain't shit to me.
I've dealt with Adam Carolla. That's what it says.
Dealt with Adam Carolla. Oh,
patient
please.
Zero.
Mike has got a picture of Phil with his emotional support vest on, just sleeping.
He is supporting the carpet.
Phil actually nipped Mike and drew blood as
well. He took a chunk out of me.
What?
Mike was the biscuit wrangler. We had to get Phil up on my lap. We're doing this whole, you know, stuck in an airplane with Phil on top of me. Bit and Phil wasn't happy about laying on top of everyone for prolonged periods of time, so Mike was in charge of the biscuits. And the thing about Phil is he'll chomp you if you put your fingers out on it. He is not nice about it. He's super laid back, super easy, and super everything, but not when it comes to food.
I get it.
Since I'm in here, should we announce what the title of the book is? I don't know if we've formally announced it yet. There's no pre-order link up yet, but
I don't know. I don't know the name. I don't know the name.
Should
of
you announce that?
I don't know the. I know the idea of the name. I don't know the exact wording of it.
I'm your emotional support animal, a guide to our all woke no joke culture.
There you go.
Fucking awesome.
With Mike Lynch doing the writing. We're almost done with the book. I think we'll be done with the manuscript when.
Due December 15th, we are about 48,000 words in. We got about two more chapters left to write.
I tell everyone all the time, please take your it's an example I always use. Which
Job
is,
and shove it.
You could eat a Pontiac if you took it, ground it down, and sprinkled it over your cereal every day. And in 2 years, you will have ingested an entire automobile. And it's doable. Like Mike and I just breaking off pieces here and there, going to be in the car, going to come down and knock out a few things. I'm on my rowing machine. Mike's sitting on the ground on this computer on his lap.
God, I'd love to see that montage.
Reading chapters.
You in various situations of transport.
He's up late. I'm driving home from the comedy store. You take it and you break it off into pieces. And before you know it, you're heading it you know, 50,000 words. I mean, how many different times did you work on this book? I think people...
Three times, fool!
People make this mistake where they go, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to write myself a book, and it's like, no, you're not.
I'm trying to quit cold turkey. So it's just not going to work.
Right. Just break it off into pieces.
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple of marathon sessions when I knew you guys were going on the cruise, and I wanted to have, you know, a couple chapters for you to review while you were on the cruise. And then it was... You know,
it's part of the process. You factor that into the steps.
Right. And then there were shorter versions where we had 20 minutes on the phone and we, you know, focused on one short bit.
And that was Mike Lynch back in 2019, giving a little
Hold
more
down
insight.
For all those remote freelancers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He, by this point, he's already living in Boston, and he's been living in Boston for a long time. And
Mike August has insulted his house.
It's so good. And yeah, it's incredible how Lynch manages to squeeze more time in to fit our little podcast, because
he's got a professional life and a family. Yeah. That's great. And then he has to, like, again, cope with Mike August's abuse about his house.
Yeah. Fun fact, Mike Lynch writes every intro joke.
Of course, we all know when he doesn't. There's some clear signs when it's lyrics from a song.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, if it's ever lyrics from a song, it's the universal language for, yeah, I'm really busy today. Just deal with it. All right, let's get going with our next clip. And we'll hear some more from Mike Lynch back in 2020.
Adam Carolla Show, 2762. Mike Lynch, Dan Dunn, not in this portion, Gina Grad, Brian Bishop. This one was recorded February 27th, 2020, and released the following day. And it's interesting because it's right when COVID's about to happen, or happening.
Yeah.
And this is Mike Lynch on the show. Check it out.
Rare studio appearance for Mike Lynch.
Hey, everybody.
Co-author of I'm Your Emotional Support Animal. Is that what it's called?
Yes, it is.
I got to think about everything I say now because there's like too much information.
Well, we tweaked it at one point. It was I'll be, and then we changed it to I'm.
Oh, that's what it is. So, the book is finished, and I think it's very much in the vein of In 50 Years, Wallaby Chicks.
Yeah, it's a spiritual sequel, I'd call it. It actually stemmed from that idea of kind of doing a sequel to it, but not a direct sequel.
You've got your practice up and running.
That's right. And hello, too. I got several clients out of my last appearance on this podcast. There's a couple of fans that are coming to see me now.
Well, Mike is good. And I'm not, I don't know, I guess you'd come to me if you want to find out good architecture or good automobiles, but good psychologists, good therapists, I think I have a pretty good handle on that. And Mike's good. And, I talk shit about my dad all the time, but the one thing he does have is that sort of ability. And I sort of got some of that from him. Definitely. And then I did Loveline for a million years. So I have a decent idea of, like, people that have good ideas or bad ideas are in the psychodynamic sort of world. And Mike's good at it. And then Mike's also very motivated by it. Would you say that?
Yeah. No, it's definitely it's a passion for me, for sure. I'm better at this than I was as a writer.
Yeah, but we got to sell the book. Shit. Sell the book about therapy. No, you did it. I think you took something that you had a natural ability in, it's just psychology and therapy, and then you really got a ton of training in it. So, like, anything you have a natural gift for, and then a bunch of training that kicks in, you eventually get great at it. It is interesting to me, the people that are interested in that process, and then most who have in whole cultures that probably have no interest in it at all.
Yeah.
It's always a little confounding to me, because understanding, you know, we always kind of talk about, well, these kids, they graduate high school and they can't balance a checkbook, you know, or they don't know how to fill out a job after they change a spare tire. Like, these are basic skills that everyone needs, but and not everyone needs it. Like, some people don't change a tire in their whole lifetime, right, or they call AAA. But I don't know why more people aren't interested in the psychological world.
Absolutely. I think it should be mandatory. I really do. I think that it's like dental health. It should be something that if you're not taking your kid to therapy, like,
you should be getting DCF on you. Like, because nobody escapes childhood unscathed. Nobody.
Mm-hmm.
Whether there's like full on trauma or just, you know, every parent screws up. I'm a parent. I screw up. You can see the product of my screwing up out there.
Yeah. But yeah. So, you know, and my bigger thing is like, look, the parents stayed together and they raised a kid and they got the kid some therapy and whatever. We'd be living in a utopia inside of 17 years. You wouldn't have to lock your doors at night. You know what I mean? No one would need a, never need an alarm on their car or anything. They could just leave the keys in the ignition. Like, I don't know why there's not an emphasis on that or even a discussion.
Yeah,
I've never heard in the pantheon of the most progressive and most woke politician, I've never heard one of them ever discuss this subject ever.
Yeah, I mean, they'll talk about like mental health in the context of like, well, we don't want kids shooting up schools, but it's like, if that's the extreme that it has to get to before you'll give a shit about it, like that's
right.
That's crazy. I'm like you. I have no idea why people don't want to know why they do what they do. You know, there's a rudder underneath our ship that is constantly steering us in one direction or the other, and why we don't want to know what that is so that we can course correct is beyond me.
Well, I just extrapolate it. I look at it as people who are constantly late, let's say. And then they're late, and then you go, hey, man, you're late. And they go, whoa, the traffic was, whoa, blah, 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 blah. And after the 57th time you hear why they were late, you start realizing, oh, they don't want to examine this. They don't want to take a look at it. They just don't want to, they don't want to fix it. Well, I don't know that they don't want to fix it, but it's never going to get fixed unless they take a look at it. And obviously, if you're blaming traffic or what have you, then we're not going to have a good shot at fixing it. And I don't know why there's this marriage to it. Like, you have this quality. That quality is being late. That quality negatively affects most facets of your life and many relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it so sacred? Why so precious? Why can't we take a look at it? Why can't we take a look at it? The same guy or gal or whatever may go to a golf pro and he's telling you, you're pulling your head up a little on your backswing, or you got to keep your elbows down. And you go, okay. And then the person may have a personal trainer or they have a physician, and the physician puts them on a scale and tells them they have to lose a few pounds. They don't punch the person. What's so sacred about this psychological stuff?
Yeah, I mean, we can get into the weeds on it, but I think there's something about identity. And when we start to change our identity, it reminds us that we're going to die. If we're changing anything about ourselves, it gets us to that, oh, I'm changing, therefore I'm on borrowed time here, therefore I'm going to die. And so people cling to the known, like late guy, you're talking about, I'm late guy, I am being the key part of that sentence. Nobody wants to change the thing that they are because it's a reminder of mortality.
It's a very astute observation and interesting, because I think the fast answer that a lot of people give is, well, when you're talking about your golf swing, that's not them. But when you're talking about being late, well, that's them. And then they can't think they're a bad person or whatever. But I've always never really I've sort of felt that way about fear of success. Like, I'm like, does anyone really have a fear of success? I don't know that they do. I think the mortality thing is a more interesting angle, because you have this thing, you're late, and I'm saying you're late, let's fix it, but I'm not saying you're a bad person. I don't know why you would hear it that way, but the change in the mortality thing is kind of interesting.
Well, I think it's, you know, I'll push back a little on that, like, fear of success thing, because I think there are people, like, they just see themselves as unsuccessful people, and they wouldn't know how to change it, and we know plenty of them, and they, that's their identity too, is that, you know, back to the book, we have a chapter called It's Not All Good in the Victimhood. This idea that we get stuck in our victimness. You know, we get stuck as the person who gets yelled at for being late. We get stuck in the identity of you know, the person who is unsuccessful. There's a line from a Nirvana song where he says, I miss the comfort in being sad. And I always liked that twist on words, because the comfort and sadness don't feel like they should go together. But he's talking about, I'm sad guy. That's what I'm used to. I wouldn't know how to not wallow. And it feels weird. You know, Paul Simon has a song, I can't get used to something so right. And that idea of, oh, it's right. It doesn't feel good. That's not what I'm used to.
Yeah, and I think we all have to try to identify what we're, what role we're playing in this world with the people we cast around us. But I see it so clearly oftentimes, and I realize, like, every once in a while I try to get together with my sister, and my sister will, like, send me a text or something, and last time I didn't get back to her. And then she wrote me another one, like, hey, it hurts my feelings. I don't like, you know, I feel bad. You make me feel bad when you don't, whatever. And I said, okay, sorry. You know, let me come back from out of town and let's get together. And then I shot her an email, like, hey, you want to get together this weekend? And it's like, yeah. And I was like, what time? And it never happened. Because the point is the victim thing is stronger than getting together. Mm-hmm. The getting together, it's just a vehicle to get to the victim part. Right. I don't think she knows it, but right. But we're not getting together. If we wanted, if the goal was get together, we'd get.
Right.
It was open this weekend. I was like, hey, we want to get together. I didn't hear anything after that because there's no victimhood in that.
Right. Well, that rudder underneath your sister's ship is I'm not cared about. I mean, we know all the tales of your mom and dad and the you know, running away from home. And, well, she'll show up eventually. So she has this, if I can psychoanalyze your sister, having never met her, she has this no one cares about me thing and maybe secretly plants little seeds to make sure that that happens.
Well, when you interrupt that by saying, let's get together this weekend, it interrupts the theme.
Right.
And so you then what it ends up being is sort of confusing because, and anytime anyone is confused by an action, look for the theme. So you go, this person wanted to get together. This person's feelings were hurt because we didn't get together. Now I'm saying to this person, hey, let's get together. And I'm not getting a response from them. And I'm offering the thing they wanted to do. I have found that multiple times in life where with various individuals where you go, I'm going to give you the thing you've been wanting the whole time. And that really upsets them.
Yeah.
Oftentimes.
It's saying they want the whole time, but not saying, secretly wanting.
Right. Right. And there's a lot of that out there. And it's why I always go nuts on any politician that tries to turn any group into a victim. Cause I just, it destroys anybody ever thinks themselves the victim is just destroyed almost immediately and has a license to do whatever they want. Once you become the victim, then you get to do whatever you want. You can act, you can steal, you can do whatever you want because somebody else, you've been victimized.
Right, by them. If there's a them, then there's an us. And if there's an us, there's a superiority to it.
Yeah, I get where it's attractive in a certain way to go, like, you know, as a fill in the blank, as a gay American, as a black American, as a transgendered, whatever. Like, I get where it's alluring, but why is that so attractive? It never works out. Like, it never really serves the group. You know, there's always like Al Sharpton gets rich, but that's about it.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it gets down to we want to feel like we're part of a group. I mean, I think that it's built into our evolutionary history, you know, which monkey did better, the one that was on his own or the one that had another one looking out for predators and one that was out picking berries and one that was picking nits off of their back. We're wired from our evolutionary history to be in groups. And so we want to identify with a group, whether it's as innocuous as Yankees fans or as innocuous, I don't know if that's the word, but as bad as, you know, we are these victims of whomever.
Yeah, it's so attractive. And obviously, it's very attractive because there's some politicians that their entire world is just built about speaking to individual groups. And it wouldn't, if it didn't get any traction, then politicians wouldn't. You know, all politicians do is lick their finger, hold it into the air, figure out which way the wind is blowing, and then just go out and start saying whatever it is they.
Right, and politicians of both stripes. I mean, you know, it's the Mexicans are coming to get you, or the robots are coming to get you. Either one, or the government's coming to get you. It's all about, you know, playing to that fear of them.
Oh my God! Imagine, I just had a horrible thought. What if someone invented a Mexican robot?
It wouldn't work.
What's that robot? He's taking a nap against a cactus? Is he drunk again? He's supposed to be on the factory floor making Subarus. Well, he's taking a me day. He tagged the outside of the warehouse. Wait a minute. We're losing money. So what are some other chapters in that book? Put that in the book.
And that was Mike Lynch back in 2020. And that was right before all the COVID stuff, because that was the very end of February. All right. Let's get going with one more clip. We're going to just go to last year, the beginning of last year, January of 2021, and do a bit with Lynch that really originated with some of Lynch's old stories. He just has the best Tales from the Cheap, and it's a segment they've been doing since the radio days, so why don't we hear some more of that?
Adam Carolla Show 2970, Greg Fitzsimmons, Mike Lynch, Gina Grad, Brian Bishop, January 2021, Tales from the Cheap with Mike Lynch.
We'll do Tales from the Cheap, and I wrote down a few things. I think Gene and Bald may have something to contribute as well. Also, Fitzdog, probably. He got a prompt on it as well, so he might have some thoughts about cheapness in the family. Also, you know, we grew up, at least I did, in a time, I think Gene and Brian too, Fitzdog for sure. Mike Lynch always famously tells us about the story about the bottom of the Chevette.
The
floorboard of the passenger side, I think, on the maybe it was a Chevette. That could have been Kevin Hench's mom's car, a diesel Chevette, like the slowest car on the planet. But either way, the rust got it over there in somewhere outside of Boston. And his dad used a stop sign and pop riveted on the floorboard to create a new floorboard, which is, again, it's cheap, but also shows some ingenuity. So I kind of like it. I have a cheap and ingenuity story myself, which lost me a go-kart race, and we can get into that. So should we bring Fitzdog? Should we play the intro and bring Fitzdog on after the intro? Take your calls as well.
20-year-old Tupperware. Homemade clothes, powdered eggs. It's time for Tales from the Cheap.
Oh, powdered eggs. Good to see you, Fitzdog.
Hey now.
I don't know if you guys were ever experienced the powdered milk, which was a thing back in the day. No. I had some friends. They'd have the Tupperware container, the tall boy Tupperware juice container with the flip spout on it. And I had a friend that did powdered milk, water, and maybe stepped on it with some actual skim milk, like cut it with some real milk. It just tasted like fucking watery ass. My thing was always, if you can't afford milk, you can't afford kids. Yeah. It's like the most basic product.
Like, that's the entry level.
Literally a mother's milk. You know what I mean? Like if you can't fucking afford milk, real milk, you give those goddamn kids away. But Fitzdog, you grew up in a fairly affluent home with very interesting parents. I'm still very intrigued with your dad especially and your mom as well. But were they cheap?
That's exactly it. We had the money, but we didn't have the money. Like, they tried to live above their means. Like, we belonged to a country club, and it wasn't a fancy country club, but it had a golf course, and it was in New York, so it was all Italians and Irish. Mm-hmm. And it was called Knollwood, but my father would call it Cannoli Wood because of all the guineas.
Nice.
And we belonged there, but we didn't belong there. We would like my parents.
You didn't belong.
My parents bought me like these shitty children's golf clubs, mm-hmm. and no balls. And so I was forced for all the years we were there. I was the biggest thief at Knollwood Country Club. I would go in the men's locker room. And when the locker room guy wasn't around, I would go in the lockers and I would steal balls and change.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a snack bar and we were given, my mother gave me a $10 booklet of money for a week at the snack bar, which basically meant you're going to have to steal coupons from other people's books.
Right.
Because everybody kept their books in a box at the snack bar, and I would just rip out dollar tickets so I could nourish myself.
So
the balls is the perfect crime there, because none of the golfers I know is going to know if they're missing one ball out of 12 or out of 15. You know what I mean? Just take a ball here, take a ball there.
Yeah. It was, unless it had like, sometimes they'd have their name on it.
True. Yeah. Monogrammed.
But
yeah.
You don't take those. You take the ones that are clean. You take the clean balls. And, there was a lot of thievery, and we were like the white trash family at the country club.
Yeah. Fitz Dog was trying to steal the balls, and it's like, God, these Titleist brothers are all over the fucking place. You can't avoid these guys. It's the Nike family and the Titleist family.
Right.
There's only two people at the club.
They would have buffets on Friday nights. They would have a buffet, and my parents would pay for one of us, and that one person would get a plate of clams and go to the side of the porch, give them to the other kids. It was like a fucking scam. It was like,
move.
Yeah, it was like the Depression for us, but we wanted to belong to a country club, and so they crawled their way in.
I'm not sure what's worse, although I do think maybe it's a grass is always greener, but there's the cheap families because they're dirt poor, which at least has context. And then there's the cheap families who have some money, which actually is kind of rubbing it in, because now it's like they do have money. They're just choosing to make me steal clams, golf balls, and and meal tickets.
When you talked about powdered milk, that just made me think of, we had friends growing up in all just, you know, kind of regular middle class Kansas, whatever. But at one friend's house, we were only allowed to have two things for snack. And I had never heard of either of these, and I wouldn't recommend them to anybody, but the kids loved them. They were called Old Nellies or Whoa Nellies. It was a piece of white bread buttered with sugar on it.
Oh, yeah.
Which was horrific.
Yeah.
And then for dessert, you've heard of this?
That's not dessert.
Sounds like dessert.
No, for dessert, they didn't have ice cream because ice cream was too expensive. So they would freeze Cool Whip and dole that out. And that was your ice cream. But these were like regular, Kansas, they were our neighbors.
Yeah,
you know, the thing about the powdered milk is it's really like the people, like back when I was poor and I could only afford to put in $4 at a time into my gas tank of my truck or something. It ends up being so much more work. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Without any savings whatsoever, and the potential of being stabbed at an Arco in our lead at 4 a.m. Right. But... And running out of gas.
You had to go to the Arco because it was 4 cents cheaper a gallon.
The powdered milk is, it's not free. You have to buy a box of powdered milk, and then you have to make it. There is the production time. There's what are you worth an hour kind of thing. And then there's the final product, which is horrific. So you have the money, you have to spend the money, you have to take the time, and then the final product tastes nothing like milk. So for actually the price of a gallon of milk, you're probably breaking even once you factor in your own goddamn labor, number one. And then number two, the product is so subpar that it's essentially you're punishing yourself, but you're also reminding yourself you're poor.
Yeah.
Every single time you open the refrigerator, there's that big tub of powdered milk going, you're a loser.
Loser juice.
Loser juice.
And God forbid you want to have a friend come over for dinner. You're horrified. You have to hide your shame.
Yes. Yeah. I didn't have to talk my friends out of coming over for dinner. Once they
were on board.
Once they experienced the majesty of my mom's vegan lentil soup and actually eating a bay leaf that was floating on top of it and almost choking on it, it was like, we'll do my house and pork chops. And I was like, I'll be there.
My mother used to make a dish called, because I was born in the Bronx and my parents were poor growing up, so they never got out of, even though we had money, they never got out of that like poverty mentality.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My mom for dinner, I'm not making this up, she would make a thing called gluck, which she made up. and you take really low-end ground beef, you butter a pan, you sprinkle the meat into it, and then you serve it on buttered white bread where it immediately soaks through and falls apart in your hands. No vegetables. I don't believe we had a salad once in my entire childhood.
That's a not a sloppy Joe.
Yeah.
No, because sloppy Joe would entail spices, tomato sauce.
It's not a sloppy Joe. Yeah.
You're right, right.
Gluck is also the name of a short-lived Nickelodeon game show.
You got that stuff dropped on you.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think the fact that it was scalding hot is what got the lawyers involved and shut down production almost immediately. Everyone went full Michael Jackson on the set of a Pepsi commercial. There's a timely reference.
That's right. Good.
Yeah, my ingenuity meets poverty story was something I was reminded of recently, which is I went to an alternative school, kind of a hippie free-range school in like the third and fourth grade. And we decided to have a go-kart race where everyone would build their sort of downhill coaster go-kart in the garage of this school, which was sort of a house. And then we would go have a big downhill race. And here's an interesting tidbit. The downhill race, there's not a lot of closed off downhills in Los Angeles. I mean, you could definitely go down to Silver Lake and find a slope, but you could also hit a car that's coming up the hill. The old zoo, the old LA County Zoo, people don't know this. Maybe you can find this somewhere, Max Zapata. The LA County Zoo, which is kind of in Griffith Park now, that's the new LA County Zoo. The old zoo, 100 years old, is further down the way, probably a mile or two away, and one up the hill, and was all closed off, but had those paths, those big, you know, like if you picture the LA County Zoo, big wide walking paths going down the hill, had the old cages and stuff still in there.
Is there anything more haunted than an old zoo?
Yeah.
Abandoned
zoo.
Yeah.
They say if you close your eyes, you can hear the sound of a llama being sexually assaulted by a drunken keeper.
I've heard that.
The first zoo was called Griffith Park Zoo, and it opened in 1912.
Wow.
So by the time we got to the 70s, they just completely moved it, but they moved it like a mile up the road, and they built a new zoo. I wonder when it was decommissioned.
It closed in 66.
Well, I got to think, if you make it through the Depression, if it started in 1912, those cages were not to keep the animals in. They were to keep people from coming in and eating.
Right.
With skewers.
Yeah.
Yes. So we then went up there and had the big day and the big race. And I was kind of the odds-on favorite because I was sort of the cracker jack. I was sort of the athletic kid, and I built a cool cart for myself and so on and so forth. But here was the issue. Wheels. Oh. Wheels ain't cheap. Like, they had the hardware store by my old house, and you could see those red wheels, if you can kind of picture those ones with the ball-bearing sleeve in the middle of them, and they had the 10-inch and the 5-inch and the 7-inch or whatever. Those things were like $12 a corner, and there's no fucking way the Corollas were ever going to buy a new set of wheels for their kids' go-kart, even though it would have been completely appropriate because it's a good project. You know, I built the go-kart, now let's go buy the wheels.
Yeah.
No.
Between the go-kart and cars, does your parents never spring for a new set of wheels?
Never. But I'll tell you, we had an old set of wheels, and the old set of wheels was my whole childhood. We had this old power mower, this lawn mower, the old school push-the-mower style with the blade on the bottom. And, of course, the engine was all jacked up, and the thing never ran, and it just sat in the backyard rusting out. And by the way, our lawn was either 3 foot high and brown or dirt. We didn't really, if you have the picture of me jumping my BMX bike in my front yard, you can get a glimpse of the majesty of the Corolla's front yard. It was just literally a dirt front yard. And somebody figured out, it was my grandfather who was sort of half involved with his family. I mean, with his grandkids, in the sense that he was sort of there and was sort of like, well, you're going to build a go-kart. We got to get wheels for it. And he found this old, if you can see a picture of me doing a cross up on my BMX
Whoa,
bike when I was,
nice.
When I was 11,
Sweet.
Catching good air, by the way, but you can see the brown dirt lawn that I was landing upon.
It's only brown dirt.
Wait, is that sunny?
This is SoCal too. You know, this isn't like, well, once the thaw hits, we'll put some sod down. No, this is SoCal. People don't have brown lawns in the middle of Valley Village, but yet there we were. So my grandfather pulled the four small white plastic wheels off of the old lawnmower that had been sitting out there. But the problem with those wheels is they weren't ball bearing wheels. They were just a plastic wheel that went on to a nut and bolt. And the nut, I should say, the bolt was like smooth and then threaded on the end when you put it inside of the mower housing. And it created a bit of an axle. But it was just a sort of plastic wheel rubbing on a steel shank. And
it wasn't built for speed?
No action.
What could go wrong?
No bearing. Like, I'll put it to you this way. If you would take one of those bearing wheels, put it on an axle and spin it hard, it would go around 152 times. If you did it to a lawnmower wheel, it would turn a half a turn and then stop, right? And it was like jiggly and everything. And my grandfather figured out that those are four free wheels. So he pulled the wheels off of the go-kart, or I should say off of the lawnmower. And then he had to figure out, how do we do an axle for this go-kart, and how do we attach the wheels to the axle? And he came up with a fairly ingenious plan.
Mop handle?
He took a piece of galvanized plumbing pipe.
Okay.
You know those caps you can screw on the end of the galvanized plumbing pipe? He took two pieces of that. He put the caps on the end. Mm-hmm. He drilled a hole in the end of the cap.
Ooh.
He then put the little axle with the nut and the bolt on it through it and screwed it in from the inside and then put the caps back on. So that was my axle. And everything was great, except for there was no rolling action in the thing. And other kids had the ball bearing wheels. Even one kid pulled them off a shopping cart, but they still had bearings.
Yeah.
And even though I was the odds-on favorite, when we got to the top of the hill and they dropped the flag, my thing just kind of lurched forward and just creaked forward, and everyone just blew past me. And then, of course, we got to the bottom. It's like, come on, Ace, don't you know how to drive a go-kart? And it's like, I got no rolling action whatsoever.
This fucking Paul Newman obsession, this racing is your fucking Rosebud.
Mm-hmm.
This is you trying to get back at the third graders.
I got to be fast and I got to be first.
Yeah, right. Right.
We got
that was like the gumball rally for poor kids.
Yes. Also, it was a time when you could just show up at the old zoo with a bunch of hippies and go-karts and just have run of the place.
No locks, apparently.
They just kind of walked right in. And are there any old pictures of the old zoo, Max Pata?
I'm sure it's not touched at all. No graffiti, no needles, nothing.
Corolla's still stuck at the top.
My ghost is up there. They say if you close your eyes. So we have some good calls, but Gene, I know you got one, and I know Chris has one as well. Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. So this is I am within this Tales of the Cheap, and so is a lot of the United States. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but there is a Facebook group that is taking over the country. It's called Buy Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And you literally can put anything on there, and you cannot sell it, and nobody can pay for it. It's like a community giving, whatever. And so a bunch of my friends in New York were doing it, so I saw, like, is there any over here? They're all over LA. They're all over everywhere. It's called Buy Nothing on Facebook. And I got an elliptical glider that's never been used. I've gotten this really cool serving plate. I've given away clothes. Like, it's amazing.
I think.
However,
I think my mom and dad were charter members of Buy Nothing. I think they're. I'm what you call a legacy now, but
they had grandfathered in.
They had
their
formed.
Buster in the background.
Yeah, they're like those twins that had the idea for Facebook.
The Winklevosses.
The Winklevosses. Like their Buy Nothing plan was in place in the 70s. It just took the computer in order to really get it up on its
That's
feet.
Right.
Yeah.
Wait, but Gina, you're a celebrity. Do you feel a little bit like there's a stigma to basically being on like an online flea market?
No, I love it.
Begging for free stuff from people.
Only one time, you know, because you do a lot of like wheeling and dealing, not like negotiating, but like, okay, I can pick it up on Tuesday, or, you know, do you need any extra clothes? Because I have this bag, whatever. And so we were going back and forth, and this woman's like, are you on the Adam Carolla show? And I go, yeah.
And she goes, can I interest you in this tissue used by one Adam Carolla?
She goes, I love the Adam Carolla show. Anyway, I'm not interested in your items.
Oh.
That hurts.
So,
you should have charged her a cameo fee.
It's seriously, $25 cameo, Gina Grad. It's so fun to do. And but I pulled some ones that don't, I pulled some pictures for you that are shamelessly on there from random people. A lot of people put expired food on. So that's a big one. But here, just Kaylin, just put up whatever and we'll roll through them quickly. Three cans of Chunk Light tuna. If you would like to go to their house and give it away. A little bag of Swedish fish, a mini bag of Swedish fish. An almost completely used bottle of L.A. Lookout that is so old and abused. They had to put it upside down so you could get the gel out.
I don't think that company exists anymore.
I don't either. Some broken pots, like broken the terracotta planter pots. What else we got? Oh, a little perfume left in all of these. Please take all. We got Poison. We got every grocery store perfume ever. And just a few droplets left in the bottom. And I mean, you can literally put anything. Oh, a lanyard.
There's got to be like a pair of size 9 British Knights tennis shoes, like high tops, or other like defunct companies from the 80s and 90s.
Yes. LA Gear.
LA Gear.
And it's great because like this, the little kid here is, you know, growing out of stuff so fast. So it's great to just, I don't want to sell it. I don't want to consign. I just want to give it away. Give it to any mom out there that needs 3T, 4T, take it. So it's really fun to do this. And it's the only other thing I wanted to add, even though some of these people are clearly clinically insane. You can tell the difference between when a man comments and when a woman comments, because one woman last week said, does anybody happen to have an extra Connect Four game? My kid loves Connect Four. I just lost my job. It's not a financially great time for us. Does anyone have an extra? The first comment was a guy going, have you tried fixing it? What's broken about it? Have you tried glue? Sometimes it's the leg. It's glue. Three of us, including me, without even seeing that comment, wrote, what's your address? I'll have another one to you by tomorrow. I'll Amazon Prime it. That's what women do. But men go, is it broken? Have you tried gluing it? Maybe you should glue it. Has your son tried gluing it? No, I'll send you one. It's $10. I'll send it to you tomorrow.
By the way, when the Connect Four is a little rich for your blood, I think, you know, these aren't great times for us financially. It's a kind of an understatement.
Possibly.
That's got to be $9 brand spanking new, right?
That's why there were so many of us that were willing to just, let me give you Connect Four. I will send it to your house. What other games does he want? But it's a fun little community thing. But some of the things on there are truly comical.
Now, they're so poor, they only have Connect Three.
That's good. So, Gene, I'm sorry. Is that your contribution? That's it's not enough. I didn't know if you had a.
That's good.
That's it. That's
I didn't know if you had a personal family story that involved this.
No, I do this every day. I am all over Buy Nothing.
I like. I have a version of this, which is Latin guys who work for me, and when I'm looking in my fridge, and I see $80 worth of king crab legs left over from a holiday gathering, and nobody's going to touch the $80 worth of king crab legs. I then show up on the job site with king crab legs, half a cheesecake,
some chicken
that people don't want. And then there's the king crab thing doesn't translate. Like when you walk into a garage and guys are painting, you go, who likes king crab? Everyone just looks at you.
Yeah.
Then I have to hold the bag up and shake it.
Then I have to tell them how expensive it is, and then I send it all home with them.
Yeah, who wants some expired shellfish?
Yeah.
I got a couple antibiotics left in this bottle also.
Nothing says the jefe cares like expired shellfish. Now, I know no one got a bonus this year, but if you can dig out what's inside that thorny leg, I think you'll find your bonus.
All yours.
I remember we had a maid, and because we were rich but poor, she came once a month.
Mm.
And her name was Inez, and she was from Jamaica. And we used to take our stuff, and our stuff we got originally was defective. There was a place called Marshall's.
Yes.
There's still a place called Marshall's.
Oh, well, when Marshall's started, people don't remember this. It was only defective clothing.
Yes.
Yeah. Really?
Yep. It was all defective clothing.
Irregular.
Right.
It was irregular. Clothes. And I remember I wanted a pair of Timberlands so bad, and that was out of the question. We wore We wore like Latino guy at the worksite boots.
Right.
And so for my birthday, I open up a box and it says Timberland on it, but it's got a Marshall, but it's in a Marshall's bag.
Right.
And I put them on, and the sole is 3/4 inch further than the rest of the boot. So the heel of the boot would get soaking wet every time I wore them.
Yeah, you
and
could,
I'd be tripping over the front.
You could go to Marshall's and get like a pair of Adidas shoes with 2 stripes or an OP shirt that said OD on it instead, you know, like all these weird factory regularities. It was kind of like what they do with the Super Bowl losing t-shirts every year.
Right,
like they just send them to
Buffalo Bills 4 years in a row. World champs.
Right. Yeah. There's some impoverished village in Ethiopia that is lousy with Buffalo Bills shirts right now.
That's so Simpsons. Malk now with more vitamin K.
Yeah.
Yes. So that's how Marshall's started. Now they sort of have, I guess, everything that people don't want, but it's not defective. They were like factory defects.
I think by the time it got to our, well, Shane's way younger than me, my generation, it was just overstock stuff that couldn't. It was my first and only pair of Z Cavaricci's I got from Marshall's. Oh, that was I don't know if you guys remember Z Cavaricci's. That was a big ticket item in the early 90s.
Yeah. Although it's such a weird conceit, like when you're in the ninth grade and you got a mouthful of braces and your hair's a fucking mess and you got zits and you think you're gonna pick up some hot chick because you have cool shoes.
Yes, or like, cool pants.
Yeah, with that.
How does that translate?
There been a girl that's like, well, Brian's not much to look at and he's got a losing personality and those fucking frames are horrible, but have you seen the label on his jeans?
Not Brian Bishop. Yeah.
That girl
every
existed.
Day.
That girl existed.
Oh, and speaking of braces, the dentist told me I needed braces, and my parents told him, no, he doesn't. And what's this?
Big Madonna gap.
You can drive a truck through my teeth.
Yep. But so far, it's only been cock. All right. Mike, Mike Lynch is going to contribute. But Mike's family was insanely cheap and my family was insanely poor, but they were so depressed. And, you know, if you think about it, hang on to Mike for a second. Think about cheap, like the essence of cheap. So the essence of cheap is I want to take my family out to a meal, but I don't want to pay for 4 separate meals, so we'll go to the Red Balloon cafeteria in Van Nuys, and we'll buy the one meal, and we'll tell the son to load up on shrimp, and then he'll bring it back to the table.
Yeah. It's like getting one over on the man.
But the motivating force of cheap is still, I want this thing for my family. Oh, yeah. I just don't want to pay for it.
Right.
My family didn't want anything for their family, so they were just poor and sedentary.
There was no ingenuity.
Right. There's no, you know, get in the trunk of the car. We're going to the drive-in. Although if you think about movies, you can talk about all the different facets of poor, downtrodden and cheap families, but you really only need to focus on the movies. So my children's experience with movies pre-COVID is we will go whenever we want and we will sit where we want. And when we get to the theater, we can eat. We'll order hot dogs or burrito or some, you know, Mexican food. We'll have a cocktail. I'll have a cocktail, like whatever, whatever. That is their version of a theater. Our version of a theater experience, we had to go into a war room, like World War II, where we're like pushing around German tanks and stuff. Now, look, we'll go to the matinee at the multiplex. Mm-hmm. You get in and sit through a movie you don't want to watch. Mm-hmm. Then don't leave. Go to another theater. Wait till the movie starts. Oh, yes. You're going to miss the first 20 minutes of it. But then you slide in after the guy leaves the door and you watch 2/3 of a movie you do want to watch. And then you go to another theater. And as far as the candy and the beverages go, you're going to have to keister that shit.
Oh, yeah. Put in your goddamn pockets.
We're going. Yeah, you're going to. Yeah, you're going to experience the majesty of a Milky Way bar that's been in your hip pocket for an hour and 40 minutes before we actually open it in the theater. And just at that point, just eat the fucking wrapper. Like, do not take it out of the wrapper at that point. Drink it. Eat the whole thing. Just rinse it off and eat it. Like, and
don't forget about the standard, like, whatever they ask, you're 10 because that's where the cutoff was for a dollar more a ticket.
Right. We're going down to MacArthur Park. We're going to get you an ID. We're going to get you into this theater. We're going to smuggle in candy that we got at the liquor store because it's 40% cheaper than what's at the theater. Then we're going to have you spend all fucking day there and you'll go back and forth to the different things. And here's a dime. When you're done with this, essentially the movie theater is now going to lose money on you. When you are done bilking the movie theater, you use this dime, go to that payphone and call us and we'll pick you up in an hour. But by the way, before you use the payphone, you got to check the change hopper.
Yeah.
It could be another dime in there.
Right.
Wait, they gave you a dime? They didn't just say, don't accept the collect call. We'll know who it's from.
Yeah, right. Now, when we would go to the movies, there was a theater that was like three towns over and they wouldn't show new movies. All my friends were talking about Star Wars. I was talking about, you know, The Monkees.
All right.
The Monkees movie.
Sonny and Cher. Have you seen that one? All right. We got a bunch of calls up there. Lynch is going to chime in with some of his own cheapness. So we'll just roll it over into the next segment.
The Adam Carolla Show presents another honorable mention from the cutting room floor. For the 2020 Ace Awards. For Best Impression, Harland Williams as various marsupials.
What would a koala bear sound like, Papa? And then Papa?
Are you trying to seduce me?
Papa, what would some whore you met online sound like
if you
went to Barney's Beer?
Oh, my God.
Okay, what's a panda bear sound like? Then, okay. Papa?
God. All right, I don't want to be a dad. Thanks.
All right.
The 2021 Ace Awards are coming this December on The Adam Carolla Show.
It is a shame that Harlan has no kids with all those crazy animal voices, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty good childhood with crazy Harlan doing all the noises like, you know, a macaw or a toucan. Fitzdog is here, Indianapolis Helium Comedy Club, tomorrow, Friday, and Saturday, as you hear this. Also, then Tempe Improv, next Thursday through Sunday, that's January 14th and 17th. You can go to Fitzdog with a Z, Fitzdog.com for tickets. Mike Lynch has joined us, who has maybe the cheapest family of us all, although I beat him in the poor department. I don't beat him in the cheap department.
Hey, Mike, he's talking about you fuck ass.
So, Mike, we're
innovatively cheap as opposed to just cheap like your family.
Yeah. And again, I don't think my family's cheap. They were just super poor and unmotivated. So they just kind of sat there being poor.
Well, like you, Cool Whip containers were a commodity in our household, and they did get that that pink color in them because they contained frozen tomato sauce.
Oh, yeah. Yours would be every... Yeah, so the first things first is everything that could possibly hold water and had a lid was considered a durable good. Like, yes. That was considered a big-ticket item. My grandparents would never throw away like a pickle jar or mayonnaise jar, but it always had the weird rusty, crusty top on it. You know, it had that weird insert on the mayonnaise jar. And
I sent Chris a picture of one of my highlights of, there you go. So those were shrimp cocktail containers.
Oh, yeah. We had those.
Saucy. You remember those.
Yep.
And they'd still have that whiff of shrimp cocktail years later when you were drinking water out of them.
Oh. Not only that, that was our. By the way, what's up, Lynch? Good to see you.
Hey, how you
buddy.
Doing, Fence Dog? Good to see you, man.
And they hold about 4 ounces, which I think was a calculated move, so we didn't drink too much milk. It was just it was like my parents would have a New Year's Eve party, and that was the fucking shrimp they gave out. They were about a quarter of an inch long. They'd been frozen for years. And then when they were done, that was our fucking flatware.
Yeah, but you could get them through airport security now, though.
Yeah.
Couldn't you get like botulism, old shrimp cups?
Of course.
risk worth taking.
It's also, these things are also sort of indicators. They're basically tangible reminders that you're not fully loved because they're like physical. Actual tangible reminders of that because, as I always tell you guys, even when I was 25, I'd go to my grandparents' house and my grandfather, God bless him, make a huge pot of goulash. And I was like starving bachelor guy. And at some point, my grandfather was Jewish would be like, well, take some of the goulash home with you. And then I'd go, oh yeah, that'd be awesome. I lived a mile away in an apartment, you know, and, my grandfather would go, I'll load up the Tupperware and you can take it. And I'd see my grandmother like shaking him off like a pitcher, like, not the Tupperware, not the Tupperware. The Tupperware's worth $4, you know, not the Tupperware. Give him the mayonnaise jar. Take the mayonnaise jar and fill it with the goulash and bring that home, the Tupperware. And it's kind of a weird conceit because it's like, what do you really think is going to happen to this Tupperware? The Tupperware is 22 years old and light no longer passes through it. Like it's that marred. It looks sandblasted. Yeah. And it's like, but they just had this one Tupperware container. And my grandmother's biggest fear is that shit would never come back. You know, remember all those conversations of like people go, okay, you can borrow this crescent wrench, but understand. This $9 wrench needs to come back. Like, you got to bring this. Like, if you're having long conversations about things that are under $4 and how important it is that they come back to your home, like, that was, if I ever got out of there with Tupperware, my grandmother would, like, tag it like a pot of whale.
And follow our house, you know? Had our name on the bottom. I assume it did in your houses, too.
She calls them like the cougars. Did you bring back P296?
Yes. Where is it? We followed it to Carpenter Street, North Hollywood, and then we lost the trail.
We never had Tupperware because that would assume that occasionally my mother made any more food than we could consume at one meal. Mm. It was always slightly less food. She would make for five of us. She would make five pork chops, and then my dad would take two. And then we would have to carve into thirds and do math to figure out who got the rest.
And that's where the Jewish and the Irish part ways.
I was going to say, we had the different thing where she would make too much food and then freeze it for years. And then you'd have to chisel at it to get it out.
Yeah. So, Mike, beside the stop sign floorboard in the shrimp container.
Yield sign, to be correct.
Oh, sorry. Yield. Yes. Yield to my cheapness.
That was the classic.
what car was it on?
It was a Chevette. It was a maroon Chevette.
I think I got it.
I couldn't tell
it.
You the year of it. Yeah.
Any other good stories to regale?
Well, there was the classic. My sister had a Halloween costume that was a Hershey Kiss. Mm. It was composed of a trash bag and a tire, bike tire.
All right.
So there's a picture of that floating out there somewhere. And we, despite not actually being on welfare ourselves, we would take the government cheese from my grandmother, who was, because it was worse. Too much for her. Yes. So it was not only government cheese, it was hand-me-down government cheese. It was an orange block.
Secondhand.
That a good Sawzall couldn't get through.
I will. I now have another one of these sort of demarcation things for, like, was your family poor? Over, under, number would be 8, on how many times you eat spaghetti that was served up with an ice cream scooper. Remember the bad cafeteria? They just scoop it. Like, each strand of spaghetti was 7/8 of an inch long, and it was just buried in that gooey red sauce. And they'd use that scooper, and it'd show up like a half a tennis ball on your tray. Ugh.
Hey, I don't know. Do they do government cheese anymore? How is government cheese distributed? How do you get your government cheese?
Go to the government.
Yeah.
Show up at your house and hand you a
block. Well, first thing you do is you vote for Biden.
Yeah, and is this surplus cheese that the military didn't want, or are they actually making cheese for the subjects?
It was actually used as shells during the Korean War, and they just repurposed it as cheese.
Other enemies.
Yeah, there was actually, and there was powder. I'm picturing the little pantry in the back. There was the government cheese, and there was also the powdered milk, which I know. Powdered milk and powdered eggs, which, you know, I know is one of your lines, a demarcation ace for bad childhood.
Like, unless you're in a fucking foxhole, you should never get near powdered eggs.
How would rich man, poor man, too, because I think you got astronaut.
Or exactly. Mike Lynch growing up.
How do you even make powdered eggs? You mix it with water. I do kind of blame the space program for part of my shitty childhood, because we were obsessed with, like, Tang and powdered, like, just add water, like the astronauts. Like, yeah, you know what else the astronauts do? They pee into a fucking diaper. But that's not awesome when you're fucking on the ground, right?
Yeah.
Everyone was so, like, Tang was literally just sugar and orange coloring and a little, like, citric acid, and somehow this was fantastic because it's what the astronauts,
it was space aged,
and is it standard. And did the astronauts really have Tang? Like, do you think the scientists at NASA were like, we need something with zero nutritional value that weighs a lot and that is fucking covered with sugar? Like, for these guys that are trying to live in outer space, do you think really one of the NASA nutritionist scientists, do you think they really came up with Tang?
Gun to your head, Ace. Tang?
Tang was not made for space travel, but space travel made Tang famous. The sugary orange drink powder failed to take off upon introduction to the U.S. market in 1959. But once it launched with American astronauts of the 60s, labeled Orange Drink, Tang had the world's best built-in branding, according to military.com.
They probably had a healthier version of it, and then this was the commercial grade.
Adam, I was going to ask you, gun to your head, Tang or Sunny D? You have to pick one. What do you do?
Well, Tang tasted good. Sunny, I mean, it was bad, but if you're 9, it kind of tasted good. But Sunny D always tasted like ass to me, because the thing about, I guess, my taste buds is Tang was so far off of orange juice, it wasn't in the same category.
It wasn't trying to be orange juice.
It didn't compete. It tasted more like flat orange soda. Whereas Sunny D kind of tasted like orange juice, but a horrible version of orange juice. And that's what always kind of bumped me. And I think
that's another demarcation, is they used to call it either fruit juice or fruit drink. If you drank fruit drink, you were poor. There was cheese, and there was cheese food. Do you remember that? Like Kraft?
Yeah.
Individual slices had to be called cheese food.
If it ever had the word drink or punch next to the flavor, that was a bad sign. That meant you were not getting the real deal.
Speaking of all this orange juice talk, we never had like a carton of orange juice, because that was for rich people.
Oh, yeah.
But did everyone else do the concentrate?
And
trying to just get that plunger down when you were a kid was very difficult. Is that poor people stuff? Because orange juice comes in a carton.
The biggest, we had a Gelson's, which is still there, sort of near my house. And we had a Lucky's, which is, I don't know, John's or whatever, near Gina's house.
Which one did you go to?
Well, I would go into Gelson's only to steal turkey drumsticks. So Gelson's...
Wow. I didn't see that coming.
Well, Gelson's had the full deli, hot deli counter in the back. It was like back the left. Very back left, yes. And so when I was about 10... I'd go in there. I was always fucking starving, and there was nothing to eat at my house. Certainly not a Gelson's prepped turkey drumstick, like a huge drumstick. It's not an easy item to steal. You're better off doing a baker's dozen of hot wings because you can kind of spread those around, you know. But the one drumstick was like, you know, the Fred Flintstone size drumstick. But I love the turkey drumstick. So I would go to the back of the Gelson's, I would order from the deli counter the turkey drumstick, but you don't have to pay at the deli counter. You pay in the front.
Yep.
So somewhere between having it in the back and the front, you'd have to kind of lose yourself and see if you could get out of there with the drumstick, you know, tucked in your inside pocket of your army jacket or just sort of pretending like you forgot was in your hand. And I didn't have any money to buy any other items, so I couldn't really pad it out. But the Gelson's, you want to talk about the holy goddamn grail of orange juice. Again.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
I know.
The shit in the carton was way too expensive. Even the stuff from concentrate in the carton was way too expensive. Even the concentrate non-generic form was like too expensive. We had to do tap water and the Lucky Thrifty Scotch brand or whatever the fuck the knockoff shit was. But the Gelson's had a giant fresh orange juice machine. Have you seen one of these things?
The grocery store I worked at in high school had one of those, and we just fill with oranges, and it would just press them and make freshly squeezed orange juice. You'd cap it off and throw a tangerine in there once in a while. Now you're living.
Yeah, the Gelson's one, I think, had this sort of hopper with orange juice, mm-hmm. with oranges, and they would like roll down the flume, and you'd just see the action on it. And I would just sit there and stare at it like I was looking at a Ferrari through the window of a showroom, you know, like,
That was more technology than in your entire home.
I know. And the people that were actually purchasing the fresh squeezed orange juice at $6 a gallon, like, holy Christ, I'm going to stow away in the trunk of this guy's Mercedes. I don't care where he goes. And I would just stare at that thing.
We would go to C-Town, which was the shitty supermarket in town. And we were always hustling. It was like the Depression. That's why I wear those hats, those little newsy hats. We were always like angling to make a quarter or a dollar. While my mother would shop, me and my brother would try to get old ladies to let us carry their bags to their car because they'd give us a quarter.
Mm.
We were the guys that were in the fall raking leaves. As soon as it snowed, the other kids are fucking sleigh riding. No, we're shoveling driveways. We were constantly trying to make a buck. When we belonged to the country club, they made me caddy from age 13 on. I weighed like a buck 105, and I've got one of those Rodney Dangerfield bags on my back. I'm walking past the pool. All the other 13-year-olds are laying out. They're playing pool tag. They're playing ping pong, and they're looking at me going, what the fuck is wrong with you? You're a member.
We got some calls up here. I like Joe and John and other John from Ithaca and Cleveland. Hang on. But Joe was told to bring his own pizza topping. So I'm very into this guy. Joe, 42, Seattle.
Hi, guy.
Hi, guy.
Oh, real quick, I just want to say, Brian, your health update that you gave right before the break. Thanks for updating everyone. I'm sorry to be here. It's been a tough last couple of months, but I know you said you were worried that you weren't sure if it had come through on the show or not. But completely honest truth, not trying to make you feel better, I absolutely couldn't tell. I thought you'd always sounded just the way you always had. So
Joe hasn't listened to a show since 2019.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, yeah. Not a good
thanks,
sign.
Joe. I appreciate it. Very nice.
Yeah. No, I meant even better than normal. But you know, I hope 2021 will be a little bit easier.
Thanks, buddy.
Pizza.
What's your tales from the cheat?
it's going to be hard to top Gina's story about self-repairing a Kinect 4 kit instead of just going out and buying another one. Gina, when you were talking about the post in the Buy Nothing group, did you have any guys that said this? Because this is the first thought that came into my head. You can play this game with pencil and paper, right? If your Kinect 4 set breaks, you just draw it on a napkin.
It's called tic-tac-toe.
Did any guys suggest?
Right. Yeah, no, not yet.
All right, Joe, pizza topping story.
Pizza. So Domino's and a couple other companies, they have like these coupons that you can order pizza for pickup for like $8, but they're very strict about, you know, three toppings only. And if you go over that, they start charging $1.50 or $2 for each topping. And, you know how this is. It's like, even if you can afford it, if it starts out saying $8 and by the time you're done, it's like $14, you still feel like you got jobbed. So I have my own supply of things like, you know, the marinated mushrooms and the artichoke hearts and the capers supply. That I just keep, and anything that's not like the meat that has to be cooked into it to taste good.
All right, hold on. Gina, hypothetical.
Yeah.
In terms of, let's just say there was a flood in your vagina.
Sure.
And you needed to air dry it real fast.
Wow.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Guy who picks you up on the date with the Lyft Uber sticker on the car. Guy with the Ralph's Club lanyard hanging from the keychain. Or guy who brings own pizza toppings out on the first date.
Oh, wow. Wow. I think we know.
I think we know.
Oh, man. I mean, at least he said marinated mushrooms, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Is it because he preferred... If it was someone who was like, you know, I go to the, you know, I want the delicacy stuff. I want the artichokes. I want the marinated mushrooms. I'd be like, ooh la la, get a mop. But if he's just trying to save $1.50. Yeah,
these are green bell peppers.
Now we have a problem. Now he has edged out the Ralph's Club guy.
Right. But also... It's kind of catch-22 because if this guy is like, well, Godfather's doesn't have truffles, you'd be like, well, maybe you should go to a normal pizza place that's better.
Yeah, that's true. That's a very good point.
All right.
That's a good, nice, deep Godfather's pull.
Thank you. All right, we'll do one more. I know we'll do two more, but I know Lynch has a hard out, so I'm mindful of that, Lynch. Let's see. Let's talk to but Joe over here. That's self-imposed cheapness. That's not a parental thing or familial thing. That's him imposing on himself. John, 46, Cleveland.
Hey guys, happy New Year. So it is insane that you brought up fruit drink earlier, because my story is about my dad taking a stand over fruit drink with the county sheriff, and it's crazy you brought that up. So anyways, I grew up in Cleveland. This is not a net worth thing, by the way. My dad was very well employed. This is strictly about hating things that cost more money than he thought they should. So we did not grow up going to Indians games or Browns games. We went to indoor soccer games, and only on weeknights. Because I later found out the tickets on weeknights were 2 for the price of 1. So the day of the game, he would boil up some hot dogs, wrap them in tin foil, and then he would go to the local convenience store and get 2 little wax cartons of fruit juice. Oh. And I remember from age 9, they were 25 cents a piece. Oh, yeah. So he does this for several years. And then finally, we go to the game one night, they go through the bag, and they say, new policy, no drinks allowed from the outside. So my dad immediately demands to talk to a cop. So he starts getting into it with this cop over the 2 fruit drinks. And the cop does that thing that scared the hell out of him even as a kid. He starts mumbling into the walkie-talkie on his shoulder, you know?
Yeah.
So the next thing you know, the sheriff of Summit County, Ohio, is standing there going back and forth with my dad about allowing him to bring fruit drinks into the event. So he tells my dad it's for safety reasons, because you could throw the full container of fruit drink unopened. You could hurt somebody with it, which, by the way, you guys probably know, did happen in Cleveland a few years later with a Browns game.
Oh, really?
Well, oh, yeah, the money.
Yeah, the bottle game. The sheriff was right. You could kill somebody with a thrown bottle. So here's the money shot of the story, though. My dad tells the sheriff, I could use anything as a weapon. I could take my wallet out, and I could throw that and use it as a weapon. And I swear to God, as a 9-year-old, I actually remember thinking to myself, no one involved in this conversation thinks you're taking your wallet out of your pocket, let alone throwing it anywhere. So,
well done.
And my dad couldn't have pulled that one off because there was no money or credit cards or anything of weight inside of the wallet.
Moths.
A good wind would have kicked up. It would have spread its wings and went to the heavens.
Yeah, mine had plenty of money. He had plenty of money. He was an engineer.
Also, my dad could never do that because it always took him at least 20 minutes to get his wallet out of his pocket. So there's no way if an intruder attacked us, he could do it in any kind of timely fashion. There would have to be a long discussion about what a dollar was worth and how money didn't grow on trees. And you should talk to your mom. Thanks, John. All right, we'll do one more. Lynch, I know you got a hard out, so we'll you're okay. All right,
you can stick with... You told the patient to hang tight.
Stick with...
he's a fan, actually. He'll wait.
Okay. One more call. John 53, Ithaca, New York.
Hi, Adam and gang. It's
Hi,
a pleasure
guy.
To speak with you. I'm a big fan. And I called because I had great stories about my father, who was notoriously cheap. He was a developer, and he owned many houses and apartment buildings that had lots of wooden decks. Now, of course, you know, due to upstate harsh New York weather, the decks have to be treated every year. Mm-hmm. So instead of, you know, going to the store and buying Thompson's water sealant like everyone else does in the world, my father would grab an empty 55-gallon drum and pour in a witch's brew of his own creation of pallets of linseed oil, paint thinner, and other various ingredients all purchased in bulk, and mix it together with a big wooden stick, and
was
then he would treat his deck for pennies on the dollar. And then one year, he decided that he didn't even want to pay for that. So my father walked into the maintenance garage and spies a 55-gallon drum of dirty, used motor oil. And where some people see a problem, my father saw solutions. He, on the spot, decides that one kind of oil is as good as any other kind of oil and instructs his crew to apply the dirty motor oil as a treatment onto the wood decks. You know, solving two problems in his mind. Like he gets rid of dirty oil and doesn't have to pay for any more treatments.
I'm laughing because I'm picturing the homeowner after your dad just mopped the deck going, honey, I'm going to go out and smoke a cigarette. I'll be back to join you and my beloved family to watch the rest of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. I just want to have my...
A little tipsy.
Yeah, looks like a Tibetan monk 2 minutes
right.
later. It was an unbelievable mess. First of all, the decks never dried, so they just remained the sticky, tacky mess. Oh.
Yes.
Second, of course, the petroleum stench was unbelievable. It smelled like the Exxon Valdez had just wiped out in the front yard. And third, the wood sucked up the dirty black oil unevenly, so the wood just became this splotchy, sooty, nasty, gross mess that was absolutely horrible. And, of course, it cost a fortune to correct and fix the way it should have been done right in the first place. And that's typical for the tales of the cheap, as my father was famous for being you know, penny wise and pound foolish. He would step over dollars to pick up pennies.
Yeah, thanks, John. Yeah, my grandfather famously added a porch on his old house that we were flopping in North Hollywood, but he wouldn't just go buy new lumber. He bought used lumber, and the used lumber was from a pier that caught on fire. So it was like waterlogged. It was like bowed and propellered. It
reclaimed was wood.
Totally uneven. And the shit, the only stuff that wasn't, you know, soaked with salt water had termites. And then he built this horrible, shitty, uneven, fucked up looking front porch that everyone would just trip over.
On one side.
Yeah, it was a fucking shit show. And so not only do you end up with a horrible product, but it's more labor intensive to build with a bunch of uneven, different sizes, different thicknesses, sizes of wood. And then you have to fucking live with it for 10 years. But that was Laszlo Gorog, everybody. It is also, but can we do this? You know, this like Drew always plays this card because like my dad was a product of the Depression. Like, all right, everybody, my family was poor. My family's cheap. They were fucking idiots. I'm not. You know what I mean? It's like saying, I won't stay in a hotel that's above three stories. Why not? Well, I was alive during 9/11. Yeah, okay. Now get the fuck over it and go up to the fucking 14th floor and enjoy yourself. Like, you can get over this shit. You can experience stuff and see stuff. And then that was Drew's thing. Drew's thing is like his dad was a physician. He always did well. But because he was 7 and a half during the Depression, Drew must eat out of a fucking coffee can for the rest of his life. Like, okay, now you're an adult. Get fucking over it. I don't.
It's his kids. It takes three generations.
Well, that's
the wash out.
It didn't happen to Drew. That's the crazy thing.
Yeah. He's got a little of that, but not nearly what his dad had.
And that was Tales from the Cheap.
I love that intro.
Yeah, with MVP OG Hall of Famer Mike Lynch. And yeah, he just has the best family story.
The floorboard, classic. Powdered milk.
So good. So good. All right. That'll do it for today's episode of Corolla Classics. And I just want to remind everybody again, please pre-order Adam's book, Everything Reminds Me of Something, Advice, Answers, But No Apologies. It's out July 19th in hardcover, ebook, audiobook. Get it for a friend. And make your summer worthwhile with Adam's new hilarious book. And June and I will see you this weekend. So thank you again for hanging out with us this holiday weekend. The Adam Carolla Show returns tomorrow. See you Saturday. My name's Chris Loxamana. That's Super Fan Giovanni.
And everybody, if you're listening to us on the 4th, have a safe and happy holiday. Make sure to get a designated driver. Be safe. Don't blow your fingers off. Make sure you pre-order that book before you go out and have your first beer. I've pre-ordered mine. Mahalo and get it on.